coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Hello, everybody. Chris Jordan here, coming at you live from Austin, Texas tonight. Hope everybody is doing okay. How you doing, Curionauts? Welcome to the show. We're going to be having an amazing guest, two amazing guests tonight. Both great, great field researchers. Both of them write for Texas Fish and Game. Our guest in the first segment is the amazing Jeff Crypto Hulk Stewart. We will be talking with him about fact versus fiction, reality versus fantasy, the what you see on TV as far as investigative work, and what really happens in the field, and what you can do if you are going out in the field to get yourself ready to collect your evidence in the best way possible so that it can be examined by even by people like me who do audio video examination work, restoration, things like that, you know, how to make sure that your work is ready to hit examination, because there is a process to that, to making sure that's done properly. And unfortunately, many of the shows that are out there, which granted have opened this conversation, it's kind of like not liking Lou Elizondo. You can not like Lou Elizondo if you want, but the videos that he brought forth have opened the conversation, and that's what's important. And yes, while many of the shows are sensational, what's important is that they have opened the mind of people to the concept of cryptid research, to the concept of these sciences, not even side. I won't even say pseudo science because that's a horrible term. It's either science or it's fun. Either way, nothing wrong with it. Now, our guest in the second segment will be Chester Moore. And we will be talking about the smiley face killers and the idea of, serial killings of recognition and crimes of recognition happening in public places like public parks, things like that. And his award-winning podcast. Now, I'm so happy for him, that he won the Southeast Texas, Press Club Award for Dark Outdoors. So we will be talking about his work in the outdoors over the many, many years, how that has changed, and how the public parks that border our suburban areas, even here in Austin, we will be talking about the Rainy Street murders right here in town, things like that, how they may be related to the smiley face killings that happened across the country, and how that may actually be sourced as kind of like a floating MO across the dark web. So it's a fun conversation in our pre-recorded segment after commercial break. In this segment, we will be talking with Jeff Crypto Hulk Stewart. Many of you may know him from the popular show Finding Bigfoot, as well as other things. He's a writer, all kinds of stuff. Welcome to the show again, Jeff. How you doing, bud?
Man, I'm doing great, my friend. I'm doing great. I'm so excited. And you know, talk about Chester. You know, Chester and I, we've been the best of friends for, oh my gosh, for many, many, many years, decades. And I've been very fortunate to be involved with Chester in Texas Fish and Game magazine, as well as his children's ministry, stuff like that, helping him out with animals and the dark outdoors. I've investigated with him on the horse killings that have happened in East Texas, all over. You just can't get a better person with such a source of knowledge.
Yeah, and true passion for the outdoors. Like I don't. Unless the man is speaking at a conference or something like that, or working with youth, you're pretty much seeing him with a fishing pole in his hand or something like that. He is always out in it. And man, it gave me chills talking with him about some of the things that he'd dug up regarding crimes of recognition in public parks, things like that. It was just fascinating to me, especially with, I mean, I lived in South Austin, like literally blocks away from Rainey Street, like within a mile and a half. It was right in my backyard, all that stuff happening. And to know that it was right there, to know that it might be tied to something else, is pretty incredible. Now, you yourself spent a bit of time carrying a badge, correct?
Yes, I did.
How long did you spend in the world of law enforcement, Jeff?
All total, I spent about 3 years.
Okay. And now, since then, of course, as we mentioned in the intro, you've been a part of shows like Finding Bigfoot, things like that. You are known for going out and being in the field, doing cryptid research, that kind of stuff. You also make numerous public appearances because of your time on Finding Bigfoot. You go out to, that's where we met, was I believe it was the Southeast Texas Bigfoot Conference in Mineola a couple years ago is where we first met.
Right. I've done Finding Bigfoot. I've done Monsters and Mysteries in America. Survivor Man Bigfoot. I spent a lot of time with Les Stroud on his Survivor Man Bigfoot series.
Cool.
Did two episodes here in the United States with him, and then there are a couple of episodes that aired on his actual channel in Canada that we did. So we spent a lot of time together. Man, it was awesome.
Well, and you know, you have a very unique insight to a couple of things, Jeff. Number one, the cryptid community. You have been involved with cryptid research and the cryptid community for smooth over a decade. And in addition to that, you have a great knowledge of field research and data gathering. And I know that you lean on your work as a law enforcement officer when it comes to gathering evidence, taking testimonies, things like that. But you also have the very unique knowledge, as a few of our guests on the show do, of how these programs, specifically the serialized programs, are put together. And we had a conversation at one point with the Klingel brothers, and even they talked about the fact of they missed their real research. Not that they weren't doing some research, things like that, on the show, but they were told where to go. You know, it's not like they were like, hey, well, this is on our target to research this year. Like once producers took over the show, it became the fact of, okay, well, these places are the hot spots that we're going to hit, things like that. And then there became the fact of, well, how do you make a show when you have 8, sometimes 12 hours with actively nothing actually happening?
Well, I mean,
because it doesn't happen every single time. Every single time you go out and knock on wood, you don't necessarily get a response.
8 or 10 days. It's more like 8 or 10 days with nothing happening rather than 8 or 10 hours.
Oh yeah.
For the simple fact, I'm 51 years old. I've been doing this since I was in my 20s. And I have had 2 eyewitness, like face-to-face encounters.
Wow.
In 30 plus years. Now, I've had maybe 10 or 15 expeditions that I've been on or investigations or whatever, where things have happened you know, sticks being thrown at us, rocks being thrown at us,
hoops, hollers, things like that.
But that's in 30 years. So to think that a TV show is going to show up on a given piece of property and go out on this given piece of property with cameramen, sound techs. On one show, we showed up and there was literally a director, a sound guy, a cameraman, and two assistants with like fanny packs on, with bottles of water and, you know, extra batteries and things like that for the cameras and all of this.
Yeah.
And we're supposed to be out there acting like we're doing research and stuff. And there's, you wouldn't have found a house cat from all of the people tromping around through the woods.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And I actually got into an argument with the director of the show, because the guy was like, okay, look off and act like you hear something and then say blah, blah, blah. And I said, no. And he said, what? I said, no. And he said, why? I said, because I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
And it ended up being a 2-hour argument between this director and myself, because I refused to lie on camera and say I heard something or saw something when I didn't.
Yep. Yeah, yeah, precisely. And once again, the idea of, because one of the things I bring up regularly, I've done a little bit of paranormal research. I belong to a couple of groups in my time, and I don't remember a time that we ever stopped investigation to look at what we took a picture of. I don't think we ever stopped investigation to rewind something and listen to it, on site. That's just not something that you do. You are in a charged atmosphere. Your mind is processing things in a different way. You know, I have even been proposing the fact on the show, Jeff, just on a quantum level. As you are preparing your equipment and everything else, are you trying to have a blank mind and not even think about the location that you're going to? You know, because otherwise you could quite literally be manifesting the phenomenon that you're trying to investigate.
So many times I've had to tell people that come up to me at conferences and out in the public in the street and things like that. Whenever they come up to me, and I mean, I've had them come up to me angry. I'm talking mad because I have said something about some beloved, famous person. And they corner me and I'm like, look, I'm sorry, but they are on television for entertainment purposes.
Yeah.
In order to ensure that show goes on for season after season after season, they have to be entertaining. They're not really out there looking for evidence. And these people can't get it through their head that the show that they're watching on television is not 100% the truth and real.
Yeah.
And I'm not meaning to say anything bad about any of those guys, man. They're wonderful people. They're great guys. You know, I spent a lot of time with Bobo Fay. I mean, James, you know, he is an amazing person. He is an amazing person. I'm talking about, you would be hard pressed to find a better human being than he. A lot of time with Cliff. Cliff is a great guy. But they had to do certain things in order to keep having a show on television.
That's right.
Every year.
Yeah. And I mean, there is a compromise to that. There is a compromise to that.
Now the people they had on the show that they were interviewing. Yeah. Those were real people and those were real encounters. But when you see them go out there and then you hear, you know, Matt Moneymaker, and he goes, there's a Squatch in these woods. No, there wasn't. No. They were on some, like, piece of property, and there were 15 people on ATVs with truckloads of camera gear and catered lunches and things like that. There wasn't a squatch within 10 miles of them.
Yeah. Yeah, not with that kind of ruckus being raised and people walking around.
Right, not that there wasn't one on that piece of property before they showed up with everybody, but there wasn't one there whenever all that was being said and done.
Yeah. Well, I have even brought up I guess the point of argument to folks that, you know, I don't mind if you use thermal imaging. I don't mind if you use night vision, things like that. But if you're flooding the area with infrared light, isn't that an animal that sees in the dark? That's kind of like broadcasting a big old floodlight for any animal that is a nocturnal animal. You know, they would see into the infrared spectrum. So yeah, that's like a huge floodlight to them. I don't know how attractive that would be to step into, you know?
And, you know, a lot of my expertise comes, I'm a wildlife expert. I have a degree in animal science. And I've spent my entire life in the woods. I mean, I live literally in the woods. And I have spent thousands upon thousands of hours in these woods, and I make it my mission to learn the sound of every indigenous animal in my area. Now, I'm not saying I'm going to go to Georgia or Kentucky or somewhere like that and be able to automatically hear a sound and tell you what animal it is. But in the state of Texas and most of Louisiana, like places really close to me here within, you know, several hundred miles. I mean, I've had, you know, so many times been out like with famous people and hear something like, oh, that was a squatch. I'm like, no, it was hogs. And they're like, what? I'm like, yeah, it was hogs. And that was a fox. You know, and like tell somebody, you know, that white-tailed deer make over 100 different vocalizations. What?
Yeah.
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 You know, foxes, you'd be surprised at the number of vocalizations that foxes make. And, you know, they're just amazed because these people have never heard these sounds before.
Yeah.
And
it is a whole different world.
Yes. Yes, it is. And it's just amazing that I get sent audio files from a lot of different researchers, and they're like, hey, I caught this sound. Can you tell me what it is? And I'll listen to it, and 9 times out of 10, I'm like, yeah, I know exactly what it is. And I'll tell these people that it's a known animal. And, man, they'll get mad at me. And I'm like, I'm sorry. I told you the truth.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just recently... in my garage ran across a tape with my grandfather's handwriting on it. There was a bunch of animal calls, like distressed rabbit, things like that, written on the tape label. You know, hunters have used this kind of stuff for years and years, to bring game in, things like that. So yeah, you know, folks who hunt, fish, trap for a living, they have a different connection to such things. Now, tell us, give us a little bit of one of your personal encounters, Jeff, before we get into gathering evidence out in the field. What was your first encounter?
My first encounter, when I was 15 years old, back in mid-80s, you know, 1984, 85, somewhere around in that area. Might have been 86. Some friends and I were camping down on the Sabine River. My family, we have a 500 and 80 acres leased down on the Sabine River, and there's like one road that goes into this property, and the only way to access it is by this one road or up the river or down the river. And we had caught a bunch of fish that day, and we had an old hand pump well. And we would clean our fish at this old hand pump well. And what I would do is I would leave the entrails, the guts, if you will, in a pile over by that. And later in the night, I would go over with a flashlight and see if there were any raccoons or something eating on those. Because back in those days, I made a lot of my money by selling fur. Back in the mid 80s, a good raccoon fur would bring you $25. You know, so you could imagine in one weekend, you know, for a 15-year-old, if I got four raccoons,
yeah,
I got $100. You know, and in the 80s for a teenager, that was a lot of money.
Yep.
And so we ate our fish by our campfire, and I told the guys at probably about 10 o'clock that night, I said, hey, I said, let's walk over there and see if, you know, there's anything on the gut pile. And my buddies were like, no, man, we're bellies are full. We're by the fire. We're not interested. So I got up, I got my .22 rifle and a flashlight, and I walked over with probably about 100 yards between where we were camped and this well. And as I walked and I got closer, everybody remembers back in the 80s, man, we did not have the flashlights like we have now. The flashlights that'll burn the eyes out of something at 100 yards. It was a 3C or D cell flashlight.
Yeah.
With a
6-volt if you were lucky.
Yes. And it might shine 30 or 40 yards, maybe. And that was like an expensive good one. So as I was walking up, I got about 20 yards from the gut pile, and I could see that there was something on the gut pile eating. Now, looking at it, at my mind immediately said, oh, there's three or four raccoons, or maybe possibly there's a feral hog eating. So I raised my .22 rifle, and I creeped up. And as I got closer, it stood up. And it stood up on two legs, and I'm sitting there going, holy crap.
Wow.
And I'm shining this thing in the face, and it, to me, all of a sudden, it was a person. It was somebody. Because the only knowledge I really had of Bigfoot or anything like that was, you know, been to the movie theater and seen Boggy Creek and Boggy Creek 2 and Creature from Black Lake. You know, we had a drive-in theater, and they showed those old movies at it on the weekend. And
yeah, maybe the $6 million Man episode.
Yeah, that's about, you know, it. Something like that. It wasn't something that was in the forefront of my mind at that time. You know, Bigfoot. So I said, "Mister, I don't know who you are, but I'll shoot you," because I was scared. Because I mean, we're in here, bunch of, you know, three teenage boys, and we're sitting here, you know, alone. I mean, we're miles from any kind of civilization, and there were no cell phones then. So if something happened, I mean, you couldn't get help until somebody showed up.
Yeah.
Somebody came to check on you. And I will never forget. I said, "Mister, I don't know who you are, but I'll shoot you." And it just looked at me. And I said it again. I said, "Mister, I will shoot you." And it never took its eyes off of me, and it took three steps backwards, toe to heel. I never will forget that the way it walked backwards, because I've had people say, "Well, maybe you saw a bear," which there are no bears here in East Texas, and I've seen one bear in my lifetime in East Texas. So bears walk clumsily when they're up on two legs. They don't walk fluidly.
Yeah, it's a lumber.
Especially backwards. And it took three steps, and once it was in the edge of the wood line, it turned and walked away. And I went back over to the campfire, and I told my friends, and they're like, "Yeah, whatever. You know, you're full of crap."
Yeah.
And the next morning, I took them over there, and right in the mud, right there where we've been pumping that well to clean those fish, right there in the mud, I wear a size 13 shoe, and I could step my foot with the shoe on it inside of a bare footprint that was there in that mud. And of course, they're like, yeah, you did that. You know, last night you came over here and you made that footprint and, you know, all of that. So I got ridiculed. So I didn't say anything else.
Yeah.
I shut up. I didn't say anything to anybody. You know, went home, told my mom and dad. My dad was like, boy, don't you ever tell anybody that. They'll think you're nuts. And so that was my first encounter.
Wow. Wow. And how did that, did it change the way that you interacted with that piece of property at all? I mean, because that, well, once again, that was a familial piece of property. So it's not like you were out there rarely or anything like that. Was it something that any family members had mentioned before or anything like that?
We were always told growing up that there were old hermits that lived in those woods around there. You know, look out for the old crazy hermit that lives out there in those woods.
Yeah.
Nobody ever said look out for Bigfoot, but it was always, you know, there's an old crazy man, an old crazy hermit lives out there in those woods.
Mm.
So I immediately filed it away as, you know, that. Maybe it was that old crazy hermit that supposedly lives out there in those woods, you know, or something.
Yeah.
It wasn't Bigfoot, you know.
Now, was that...
And then
go ahead.
Probably 10 years later, on the same piece of property, my father and I, we had caught a bunch of fish again, and we put them in what we call a live box, which is a large square box with that's made to where it keeps the fish alive. You put your fish in it, float it out in the water, and the fish stay alive until you're ready to clean them. Well, we had caught about 150 pounds of catfish.
Oh, man.
And we put them in it. This was in February, and it was very cold. It was in the 30s at night. And my dad, he said, it's too late to skin the fish tonight. We'll come back in the morning, we'll skin them, and we'll fry. Have a fish fry tomorrow for lunch. And I was like, okay, Dad. So we put them in the fish in the live box, tied the lid shut, floated it out in the water, and left. The next morning, we pull up, and it's cold. There's frost on the ground. I mean, it is cold, probably 30 degrees. As we pull up, we can see that the fish box is dragged up onto the shore. And the door is open. And Dad's like, what in the heck is going on? You know, somebody has stole our fish. So we get out and walk down there, and there are fish heads laying on the ground, like fish with one or two bites taken out of the soft, fleshy part of the fish. And there's probably 10 or 15 two, 3 pound catfish laying around that have either been eaten all except for the head, and the head's tossed down, all with a bite or two taken out of them. And my dad's looking at this, and right there beside these fish are bare, what look like big human footprints. And like I said, that's cold. There's one road in here.
Yeah.
My dad looks at me, and he says, it's true. And I said, what, Dad? He said, that story you told. He said, it's true. There's nothing that could have done this. He said, nobody had, because we're behind three different lock gates. You got to go through three different gates.
Yeah.
Coming down the road to get into this piece of property. So you have to have a key to each one of those gates. And those gates stay locked. And if somebody would have come up the river, then they would have come up the river in a boat, taken their shoes off in sub-freezing temperatures, and then waded out in mud in sub-freezing temperatures in their bare feet, opened up our fish box, and ate raw fish.
Yeah.
And my dad's like, it's true. And that was like one of the greatest moments of my life, because that, it kind of vindicated me. You know,
yeah,
my
absolutely.
Dad confirmed
my dad, the person that I respect more than anybody on this earth, my father, who thought I was nuts for saying that I saw a Bigfoot, basically.
Yeah.
Now, he just told me that there's nothing else on earth that could have done this but a Bigfoot.
Man. And any other experiences by anybody else on that property since then, Jeff? Does your family still own the same piece of property?
We have at least, we still have that 580, but the timber company that actually owns the land, we lease it from them, have since come in and clear cut that land.
Yeah.
So all of the big timber, the thickets and everything that once were there are gone.
Wow.
So a lot of the activity, but on an adjoining property, actually this last weekend, I think it was last Friday, I was speaking to a gentleman who owns property next to it. And he had some guys to come down and do some thermal hog hunting that actually, and I'm trying to get a hold of this footage, they actually have thermal footage of something on two legs that is, they said that it was jumping and hopping around out in the middle of the field.
What?
Yeah.
Why?
And I'm trying to get in touch with these guys right now to get that footage, because even though it's thermal footage, I mean, you can't say that it's not a human being, but it would be so cool to see.
Yeah, but the main thing is that even in thermal footage, you can see the coolness of a tree. You can see other details of stuff around it to get a relative size of whatever it is. You know, and depending on the quality of the thermal camera, you
could... In the middle of an open field. It was out in the middle of this field. But at the same time, I mean, you can pretty much, you can tell, you know, I mean, how big something is, especially if they have other thermal footage of, say, some hogs or something.
That's what I was just about to say. If there's a image of a hog or a deer or anything like that at the same time, once again, you've got a known quantitative of size to compare it against.
Exactly.
And quite a few hunting scopes like that even have a scale, you know, inside of them.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a known sure yardage, things like that. So
I'm not sure what kind of thermal scope they have or anything. Hopefully, sure. I've put the word out to this gentleman that I would love to talk to him,
awesome.
And hopefully he will reciprocate and contact me, and we'll be able to open a dialogue, because I would really love to be able to access his thermal footage.
Yeah.
And not only that, but since I do know the man that owns the property that they were on, I'm pretty positive that I can get access to that property.
And possibly even stake out the same location, you know,
exactly.
Something like that.
A lot of possibilities there.
Yeah.
So I'm excited about that.
Yeah, that would be an incredible opportunity to be able to go out and investigate something firsthand. And that was my next question, actually, was at what point did field investigation into Bigfoot and cryptids come into your life, Jeff?
Oh, man. Back many, 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 many years ago, whenever there was MySpace, when the internet was young and there was the thing called MySpace, I made friends with a young man named Ken Gerhardt.
And pretty cool guy.
Ken Gerhard was pretty much kind of a fledgling cryptozoologist, and he and I became like the best of friends. And he started including me in just conversations. He knew of my expertise in wildlife and animal calls and all of these things, and so he would so graciously include me in a lot of the things that he had going on. And it just really started a fire up under me that, you know, you can be doing this yourself. You have the land, you have the experiences, you know that there are things on this, on the properties here in East Texas, and you have the knowledge. So why not start doing some of it yourself?
Yeah.
And so I started finding tracks and casting tracks, teaching myself. There was nobody to teach me how to cast a track. So I just did all of the research I could on how to do a plaster cast, because, you know, back then that's all we really had was plaster of Paris available. So, you know, I would use all kinds of things, you know, drywall mud, plaster of Paris, you know, all kinds of things that were available at the local hardware store. And then I became a law enforcement officer. Actually, I became a corrections officer first. And after being a corrections officer, then I had the opportunity to move up and be a law enforcement officer.
I didn't know you were a skull thumper.
Yes. I was a corrections officer in the great state of Arkansas.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And
that's a bless you, man. That is a special and hard position.
You know, it was, but it wasn't that bad, because I have a unique understanding of people. I don't try to run roughshod over anybody, but I don't let anybody run roughshod over me. And pretty much, you know, I let those guys in the jail system know that I will crack your head open if you cross that line. But if you don't cross the line, you treat me like a man, I'm going to treat you like a man.
Yeah.
And so I really only had a problem with one or two people, and things didn't end well for them. So most everybody else didn't push the line. But so I took what I learned being an officer, and I started in applying it to my field research, along with my expertise in animals. And during all of this time, I had went back to college, and I had gotten my degree in animal science, and I have a degree in theology. I have a degree in animal science. I actually have a doctorate in theology. So,
oh wow,
that's a good one. Yes, I'm an ordained minister. Yes, I am an ordained minister with a doctorate in religion. So
awesome.
Yeah, it's probably worth the paper it's printed on. It's online. But I took all of the things that I learned and my thirst for knowledge, and I started asking questions of investigators, not paranormal or cryptid investigators, but actual criminal investigators.
Yeah.
How do you collect evidence at a crime scene? So when we were on crime scenes, I would ask the questions of the investigators and the crime scene specialists, and I would be like, okay, how do you do this? And then I took forensic classes myself, and I learned how to take evidence in a crime scene. So then I started approaching my cryptid research the same way I would approach a crime scene. If somebody's like, okay, you know, Bigfoot was here at my bedroom window, you know, and there's a handprint, okay, get back. We're going to approach this like this was a crime scene, and that is the perpetrator's handprint.
Yeah.
And so we would take things, and then I found out how expensive it really was to have DNA tested.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because people think that it's like ancestry.com and things like that. Oh, for $99 you can get DNA tested.
No.
Not really. Not when it comes to...
Not cross-sampled and everything else. No. No. Not getting things down to kingdom, phylum, genus, species, and all that kind of stuff. Heck no.
Cross-matched, I mean, there
are literally... It's commas and zeros, man.
I can't remember how many tens of thousands of animal species there are in what is called GenBank.
Yeah.
GenBank is a repository of every single known DNA of species that has been collected on Earth. And they're in a server, in a computer system. It's called GenBank. And in order to have your sample tested against all of those tens of thousands of species, it costs a lot of money.
Yeah. Yeah. I've got GenBank from NIH.gov up on screen right now about, you know, everything that they do and what you can get from them and all that kind of stuff. But once again, that proper lab testing is crazy expensive, you know, and that's the thing is that even right now, Jeff, the internet and communities have been abuzz with Mexican aliens.
Yeah.
And there's been preliminary MRI testing done, at least what they can tell, whatever it is. It's one thing. It's not, you know, like made cobbled out of like crow legs like and the, things like
the mermaid.
That.
Yeah, remember the mermaid that they found, and it ended up being like four different things, some monkey and a fish and everything. And
the Fiji mermaid, once it was actively examined, that's what it was. Even the reassembled boy that was the Nazca, the three-fingered Nazca mummy a few years ago.
Yeah.
And that's just it. It's one of those, like, even NASA pointed out, like, hey, it'd be great to see some samples of that go out for independent study, if that's the case. And if you don't see samples go out for independent study, consider that. You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, now when it comes time to do that kind of stuff, because that is why we are having you on, is, of course, to talk about the proper gathering of evidence. And what you see on TV, folks, once again, is a very curated experience. You could go 12, 2 days, 3 days, weeks out in the field and get absolutely nothing. I have said it to numerous people online. If you were videotaping that anomaly in your backyard and it was a legitimate anomaly 3 times a week, like you say, we wouldn't be having this conversation on social media. You would be selling tickets.
Exactly.
Like you'd be set. You'd be done. You know,
That's where I have a problem. There are a lot of people. And again, I don't like to put anybody down or anything, there are a lot of people that claim that they habituate Bigfoot. And they have property, and they go sit around a campfire and sing Kumbaya with Bigfoot, and they feed Bigfoot Fruit Loops out of a dog bowl and apples. And they go out there, and I'm like, well, do you have pictures? Oh, no, we don't have pictures. Do you have video? No, we don't have video. Do you have any evidence at all? No, we don't take any evidence. We put our food in a bowl out in the middle of the woods, and we come back tomorrow, and the food's gone. And I'm like going, no, wait a minute. There literally are 80 different species of animals that live right there in your woods that will eat what you put out there.
I would be prone to eat a strange bowl of Fruit Loops, Jeff.
If I found a random
bowl of Fruit Loops, I'm not going to lie. I may just eat them, you know?
That's what I'm saying. A peanut butter and jelly sandwich if I find it in the woods, I'm like, no. That old witch sandwich is just going to have to put me in the oven. I'm gonna probably eat it. You know, the old Hansel and Gretel thing, I'm going to eat the sandwich.
Yeah, if
it was that easy for us to cohabitate with these creatures, And there were enough of these creatures, like a lot of these shows want you to believe, that there are families of these creatures living in every patch of woods, in every state, in the whole country. There's not.
Yeah.
There's not hundreds of thousands of these creatures on in the United States. There literally may be as few as a couple of thousand over the entire country.
Yeah.
Not hundreds of thousands.
Well, and especially if you're talking about a species with longevity, you know, yeah. that can live a good 90, 100 years, you don't necessarily have to procreate every season, you know, to make that happen. Right.
And when we look at one of my areas that I really like to discuss is the fact that the ecosystem, there are so few ecosystems in the United States that can support, especially if Bigfoot can't be 10 foot tall and weigh 1,500 pounds and be an omnivore, because they would have to eat 90 pounds of food every single day of their life in order to maintain that size.
Yeah.
They're seen in the middle of the winter in a snow-laden, desolate part of the country that there's no food. They would die. Their metabolism, they would die. They don't hibernate, because we see them during the wintertime when it's cold. So it's like, yes, grizzly bears eat, brown bears eat that kind of food, but they only eat it for a couple of months and then they go to sleep.
Yeah.
And you can go on any stream in any place that these large brown bears are populated in, and you can see literally dozens and dozens of them eating the fish out of the streams, eating the berries on the landscape, chasing down elk and moose and things like that and killing them. Okay. But if we give these Bigfoot more of a human size, okay, now, when I say that, we got to remember there are human beings that are over 7 feet tall.
Absolutely.
And even a 7 foot tall human being can maintain his 7 foot tall, 350 pound size on as little as 2 to 5 pounds of food a day.
Yep.
Now, I have coined the term a megavore for Bigfoot, not an omnivore. I think they are a megavore, because I think not only do they eat plants, fruit, vegetables, and meat, I think they also cannibalize themselves.
Hmm. Interesting. What would bring you to that suspicion? As someone who works specifically in the world of wildlife, Jeff?
Because we don't find their bodies.
Now,
we don't find their dead.
Well, and granted, like, it just came out here in the last year that I've jokingly said for years, you know, make no mistake, given a chance, a deer would eat you. It's actually true. Like, they have found deer grazing on human corpse. All kinds of things. So, I have held for years the fact of, you know, and anybody that spends a good amount of time out in the woods, wilderness, things like that, someone like you who spends a good clip of their life and career hunting for a living out in the woods, you're hard pressed to find fresh kill.
You know, in the woods, I mean, I'm in the state of Texas. We have literally millions of deer in the state of Texas.
Yeah.
Millions. And I'm not talking about roadkill. I'm not talking about where a hunter shot one and it ran off. I'm talking about natural causes, death.
Yeah.
I can literally walk through hundreds and hundreds of acres of land and never find a
carcass
of a deer or anything that was not shot.
Yeah.
Or ran over or hit by a car.
Yeah, that wasn't bleeding out natural. Or something like that.
Yeah. So, and it's like, we have so many predators, so many scavengers, coyotes, buzzards, crows.
Exactly.
Even hawks and eagles will scavenge carcasses. Domestic dogs, all of these things. I've literally taken on my land here at my house. I have a 3-acre pasture behind my house. And I've taken a deer carcass and wired it to a post out in the middle of this pasture and put a trail camera over it. And it took 3 days for it to be nothing more than a greasy spot on the ground in that pasture. The bones were gone. The fur was gone. I mean, after a couple of rains, the fur was gone. But the hide was dragged off.
Yeah.
There was one picture that you could count over 100 black buzzards and turkey vultures and crows and a few hawks and eagles on this carcass. I mean, they were all over. My whole pasture was like just covered in these birds. And at one time, there's like 4 and 5 coyotes eating on this. And between that and the insects.
Yeah, it happens in pretty short order. It does not take long for nature to take its course. And for whatever is there to no longer be there.
Exactly. And if these creatures cannibalize their dead.
Mm.
Okay, grandma died. Well, you're talking about pure protein right there. Imagine the fact that, I mean, we're talking about, so you've got creatures that don't have shovels. They don't have, maybe they do use a pointy stick, but I mean, how do they sharpen that stick? I mean, they don't, as far as we have been able to tell, we don't find tools in the woods where they've, you know, napped a knife out of flint or anything like that. So they would basically have to kind of break a stick off that's kind of got a wedge-shaped tip in order to start digging.
Yeah.
Well, you get you a stick and go out in your backyard and take that stick and see how long it will take you to dig a hole long enough, wide enough, and deep enough to bury even an average-sized humanoid carcass.
Yeah.
Because remember, the reason we bury people 6 feet deep is because back in the old days, without the embalming techniques, 6 feet is the depth that animals can't smell the corpse and dig it up. That's why they used to bury them at 6 feet, is because the local animals and wildlife and domestic dogs would come and they would dig Aunt Polly up and eat her corpse.
Oh, in a heartbeat.
So these creatures have to be able to bury, if they bury their dead, they have to be able to bury their dead deep enough that bears, coyotes, wolves, wolverines, I mean, you name it, wouldn't come along, dig it up, and drag it. I mean,
well, and you also have to consider that. Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we discuss regularly on this show, whether it be cryptids, whether it be alien life, what have you, we have a tendency to anthropomorphize, Jeff.
Yeah,
we want to give these things humanistic tendencies. If you look at any culture across the globe that believes or has stories of Sasquatch or large hominid, they may be a tribe on the other side of the trees, things like that, but they were not something that you sat around and shared weenies with around a campfire. They, you know, they were something that, like, hey, they offer you a salmon, say no thanks. Like, don't follow them into the woods. You won't come back. you know?
Right. Most of your Native American tribes had, you know, horrible stories about these creatures. You know, there are several that I've read about, you know, tribes that had that did battle. And I think it was Leif Erikson that whenever he was coming up one of the rivers there in Alaska, where it was, and said that there were large, hairy men that lined that riverbank and was throwing rocks at their ship. So, you know, it's like every encounter before we get to modern day man was a cautionary tale.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. Precisely. And, you know.
And, I mean, like you said, we want to we want to make every one of these things like us. It's just, we did the same thing with, like, chimpanzees.
Yeah.
Chimpanzees will rip your freaking face off. And the first thing they want to do is they want to rip your face off. They want to bite your fingers off, and they want to eat your genitals.
Yeah, anything dangly, just like a dog. So anything dangly that can come off rapidly. But that's the thing, is that we want to anthropomorphize them. Even whenever you look at many indigenous tribes around the world, things like that. Cannibalism, as long as they aren't from inside of our tribe, what's the big deal?
I mean, that is
very much a Western concept, as far as that goes, and very much a civilized world concept. But whenever you get into tribal practices across the globe, cannibalism is there in numerous places. And especially whenever you're talking about the concept of survival and the fact that, well, once again, Bigfoot is not a human being. So, might be hominid, but it doesn't mean that cannibalizing its own is a means of survival. And hey, look, there's hundreds of pounds of meat, you know, bears do it. Other animals eat their own dead because it is a source of sustenance, no different than anything else. Most animal mothers will eat their young if they're not to survive, or if they are limp or game in some way, you know.
Here's a prime example. I have a Staffordshire Terrier female that gave birth about 2 weeks ago to 9 puppies. She's got 5 puppies left.
I was going to say, how many puppies do you have? I've heard these stories.
And I didn't see these puppies inspecting them. They did not look sickly. They did not eat. There's nothing wrong with them. She has an automatic feeder in her kennel that has 50 pounds of high quality, high protein, high fat dog food in it. She's not hungry. She wants for nothing, but she ate 3 of these puppies, 4 of these puppies.
Oh, poor puppies.
And, you know, there's just
Mama nothing. Knows something you don't, that's for certain.
Yeah. Exactly.
And
maybe.
And to think that Bigfoot would be any other way would once again be, I think, a little haughty on our parts, you know?
I mean, I have no proof that they are cannibalistic. It's just a theory. And, I mean, it's as valid and both invalid. It's kind of like Schrodinger's cat, you know? Well, it's both alive and dead at the same time.
I've said it on almost every show where people are like, well, where's the bodies? The bodies are probably right there with the intact bear skeletons that don't come from kills, you know, or come from roadkill or something like that. Like, if a bear dies in the woods, good luck finding the whole corpse. You more than likely won't. You'll find some parts of it.
I've been in the woods my whole life. I'm 51 years old. I've been, my father started taking me with him at 6 months of age. He would wrap me in a blanket and put me in the pouch of his hunting vest and would take me with him hunting and fishing. He would put formula in an ice chest, like pick up bottles and have it in an ice chest for me, and my dad took me. So I've literally been in the woods since 6 months of age. And I can tell you that as a person that's in the woods, when we're walking along and you see a random bone laying on the ground, you don't stop and pick it up and look at it. Hunters, yeah. Everybody's like, why haven't hunters found bones? They probably have. Nobody stops and picks it up and looks at it. And if you do stop and pick it up and look at it, maybe one out of every 5,000 people can identify a bone by looking at it as to one, what animal it came from, yeah. Two, how it may have died or got there. No, most people say, ooh, nasty, a putrefied bone. You know, they're not going to stop and pick it up. They're going to take their foot at the most and kick it around a little bit and say, oh, man, something died.
Oh, man,
unless
look at
it's
that.
A skull.
Yeah.
A skull is the only thing that people will stop and grab. But I've rarely found animal skulls in the woods that, like I said, have died from natural causes.
Yeah.
One, because skulls retain the most, I want to say this is so fun, noshable content as far as predators and scavengers go.
Yeah.
The brain, the jaws, there's just so much meat on a skull that they drag it back to their lair in the thicket or a hole in the ground or wherever their den happens to be so that they can sit there for weeks and gnaw on that skull. And as they gnaw on it, they break those bones down so that they can get to the inside of that skull at the brains. And by the time they get through crunching on these skulls, they don't resemble a skull any longer.
Yeah. Yeah. And once again, you're hard pressed to find full intact skeletons out in the wild. They are rapidly taken for product by local wildlife and even insects, things like that. Once they get a hold of them and nest in them within days, good Lord, if they're anywhere near an ant mound, have fun.
Yeah. Well, squirrels and rodents eat bones.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So if you live in an area where there are field mice, there are wood rats, there are voles, there are shrews, there are
rabbits.
Rabbits. There are
any
gray
rodent.
Squirrels, red squirrels, fox squirrels.
Yep.
All of these animals eat these bones for their calcium.
Well, not just that. It also, as they're chewing the bone and rat chewing it, it nubs their teeth down. Because if they don't do that, their teeth will grow through their own skull.
Exactly.
That's just a part of rodent life. So, chewing through that harder bone wears the teeth down for them. Things you know about critters, folks. And but quite literally, there, how can people who are going up, because they're same thing that we talked about in our pre-recorded segment with Chester coming up, there are a greater number of people in these communities, Jeff, that are wanting to go out and wanting to go out in the woods in the middle of the night, you know. Okay, I'm not going to say I didn't spend my fair share of time out the woods in the middle of the night as a kid, camping and hunting, things like that. But A, what can people do to be safe in that circumstance? And B, what can they do to begin to collect the best evidence while they are out there and not just shooting from the hip, you know, as they go out?
One of the best things that people can do is get themselves a large Ziploc bags, like one of these gallon-sized Ziploc bags. And in that Ziploc bag, put several pair of surgical gloves. And put a pair of forceps. Like, you can buy in the fishing department of most any department store, your local Walmart, things like that. You can buy these forceps that they use to get the hooks out of fish's mouths. You can get them for $3 or $4 a pair. Get you a couple of pair of those. Get a couple of pair of tweezers. Get five or six small, like, sandwich size Ziploc bags. Get five or six paper, little small paper bags, like little kids take their lunch to school, things like that. You can get those little small paper bags. If you can't find them, usually you can go down to the local liquor store. Maybe you could buy some from them because they still put things in paper sacks.
Yep.
And put things like that in there and be able to put, like, you can go in the crafts department, and it looks like the tongue depressors you get at the doctor's office, but it's like the big, wide popsicle sticks. Put, you know, 10, 12 of those in that bag. And when you go out and you find this, also, you know, put some... Even if you don't do anything, but just go to your local hardware store and get some plaster, dry powdered plaster, and put it in one of those large sandwich bags, seal up bags, and put you a couple of bottles of water in your pack, and you can find a track and start off by not going out and finding a Bigfoot footprint. Start off by finding a coyote track or a bobcat or just a neighbor's dog.
Yeah.
Find that track. Mix up your media, your plaster, and pour it. And experiment with pouring it. Take some cardboard and cut some cardboard and make a border around it and pour the track and let it dry. And then take it up and clean it off and look at that track and do this over and over and over again until every single time you can get a perfect cast of that track. Then you can go out and find a Bigfoot track or something like that and cast it.
Yeah.
Start off by taking samples, practicing taking samples from your yard. Go out in your yard and see if you can find hair from your dog, hair of any kind. It doesn't matter, squirrel hair, whatever, and take it and practice putting on your gloves and using your tweezers or whatever to take the sample. Now, remember, once you have used those forceps or those tweezers or whatever, you can't use them again until they have been sterilized. Because whenever you touch something with them, don't touch the tips with your fingers and things like that, because you're contaminating it.
Yep.
So you want to make sure that those tweezers and whatever you're using are completely sterile. And take it and put it in that sack and seal it up and mark on it the date and the time. And, you know, take 20 pictures of the track that you cast from different angles and different light settings and different flashes and things like that. The hairs that you collect, take different things and start a routine of teaching yourself how to take these samples. And then when you do go out into the woods and you do find something, then you're ready to, it'll be old news then. It'll just be second nature to do it right.
And you know, I have taught over my shoulder right now. I know that we're on the phone, Jeff, but over my shoulder sits racks of audio video gear. It's what I've done for 3/4 of my life. And it's the same thing that I tell people whenever they're like, wow, how did you learn all of that? Like time on the equipment, you know? And if you've got an audio recorder, sit around, play around with it, learn what the settings are, learn that menu and how to get through it in your sleep, you know, because when you get in the field, you need to be able to set that up in the dark.
Exactly.
You know,
and I'll tell people another thing. You can find audio files on animals and the sounds that they make.
Absolutely.
Learn, sit down and learn every animal that is indigenous to your area that you are researching in. And then go to places like YouTube and places like that and find videos and everything of those animals and listen to them. I learned by sitting there with, back when I had a little MP3 player, and I would download all of these little sound files, audio files on there, and just play them as I went to sleep. Play them and listen to them over and over and over and over. Every sound that a gray fox makes, every sound that a red fox makes, every sound that a coyote makes, every sound that a red wolf makes, every sound all the way up to domestic livestock, the sounds that they make, different bird species. I mean, you just be surprised at the language of all of these animal species. And you sit there, and after hundreds and hundreds of hours of listening to all of these animals and the sounds that they make, then when you're out in those woods and somebody says, oh, man, did you hear that? And you're like, yeah, I've heard that before. I know what that is. That is a, you know, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And you can immediately go back and find that audio file and compare it to the one that you recorded. And say, okay, before you jump out there and say, man, I got Bigfoot recorded, listen. And you hear it and you go, no, that's not Bigfoot. That's a blah, blah, blah. And now you got mud on your face because you said that you had Bigfoot and somebody else. And because there's a lot of people that aren't going to be nice like me and like just message you and say, nah, man, I think that that's a such and such.
Yeah.
There are going to be people that are going to jump on you like a duck on a June bug. They're going to belittle you and cut you down to try to make themselves look bigger and better and smarter in order, you know, to gain something from your demise. So it's best to, you know, check these things out.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, well, and that's just it. There are numerous wildlife archives out there that you can go to find that kind of stuff. I used to always love it. I used to do some youth work with my brother, and one of the retreat centers that we worked at across the bayou, the people that owned the corner lot had peacocks, and you couldn't really see them, you know, because of the size of the lot. But on a good misty morning out on the bayou, you know, having a morning prayer session, and all of a sudden you start hearing peacock calls. If you've never heard
of peacock,
you start hearing peacock calls. Yeah. People are like, what is that sound? Oh my God. I don't know, man. That's weird. Yeah. And it was just knowing what it was.
Exactly.
But there are ways to do that, and there are numerous archives out there. And as I've told folks, if you're out there with trail cams and things like that, like, even though you don't find anything on your trail cam, like, let some local colleges know that have wildlife programs that you have tons of trail cam footage. You'd be surprised, citizen science wise, what you might be helping out with, you know?
Hey, and I'll tell you what, here's a great thing. I like to tell a lot of people, do not approach researching cryptozoology thinking that you are going to make some huge scientific breakthrough.
Yeah.
And you are going to be on the front page of Discover magazine and all of this kind of stuff, because that's going to lead you down a path of disappointment.
Mm. Yeah.
Go into it enjoying being out in the woods, enjoying taking those casts, not to prove to the world that Bigfoot exists, because no plaster cast of a footprint is ever going to prove anything exists to anyone that does not already believe.
That's right.
Take them for your own enjoyment, your own pleasure, and your own education and edification. These things are awesome. And look what I've got. This is amazing. And do it for yourself and learn these animal calls and be proud that you figured out what that sound was. It can be just as much fun to disprove something wasn't Bigfoot, you know, as it is to prove that it was, because pretty soon you're going to come across something that you can't disprove.
Yep.
You're going to come across a sound that you can't identify, no matter how many files you go through. Yeah. Or you're going to be like me and come across sounds that don't belong where they're at.
Yeah.
You come across a barred owl answering calls from a red bird, from a cardinal at 3 a.m.
Yeah.
And you're going, that doesn't happen. That doesn't belong. Or you are out in the forest in the middle of the night, and as I was, a good friend of mine, Brian Impey, and I took him out on his first Bigfoot expedition, and we had something out in the woods throwing sticks at us.
Wow.
In our camp. And the first stick come flying in, and he looks up in the tree like it fell out of the tree. And I laughed and I said, no. I said, where did that come from? And he looked at me and he pointed out in the woods in front of us. And I said, exactly. That didn't fall out of a tree. That came in from outside.
Wow.
Our camp.
Wow.
And of course, that proves nothing to anybody but he and I. We were there. We experienced it, and it made everything worth it. That entire weekend, it was 105 degrees in the shade. It was miserable. We slept on the ground with nothing but a tarp over the top of us, you know? I mean, but it was the best weekend ever.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just it. You know, even in our next segment after commercial break, Jeff, Dark Outdoors is an amazing show, and once again, award-winning, won the Press Club Award, all kinds of things. But we are not trying to discourage people from going outdoors. We aren't trying to discourage people from going out in their suburban public parks or in their national or state parks. We are just letting you know that you may want to be prepared. You know,
when I go out, I'm armed, and I've had so many people come at me and say, oh, are you scared to be out in the woods? No, I'm not scared to be out in the woods, but I am armed. Even in certain parks and things that don't allow me to carry a firearm, I have bear spray, a big container of bear spray. And people were like, there ain't no bears out here. Well, it's not for you. It's for the meth head that might come up, or for somebody who has ill intentions, you know, or whatever, but I've got it. And it may hang on my belt for 10 years and never get used. It's that old saying, I'd rather have it and never need it than need it and never have it.
That's it. Exactly. And, you know, going out in the woods, going out and doing this kind of stuff, once again, it's great to have the equipment. Do you have the time behind the equipment? Have you spent your time learning your equipment and how to use it? Have you spent your time learning to gather some samples in preparation for going out in the field. Because it's not like you have to go take a class or anything like that, but you should learn a few basic techniques, things like that, like you were saying, to so that when you go out, you are prepared to collect a sample if you find it. You know, I mean, even though you know the techniques, it's not like you're collecting a sample every outing that you go on, Jeff.
Right. But don't be scared to go on YouTube and watch videos on this equipment.
Absolutely.
I guarantee you there are hundreds of videos on every audio recorder that is out on the market.
Yep.
There's videos that show you how to use it.
We call it YouTube University in my industry.
Yes. And if you are, there's nothing wrong with someone that has no practical knowledge of a piece of equipment. There's nothing wrong with going and watching some of these videos.
Absolutely.
And sitting in your living room.
You can
back
learn
when
so
I started
much
out,
from it.
There wasn't any videos on YouTube back when I started out. So I had to sit in my living room and through trial and error record dogs and the cats and the kids and the wife and everybody else, put the recorder up there and push play and then go get my footage or my audio file and download it and then do this with it, that with it, and blah, blah, blah. Which voice is the kids and which was the dog barking? What was the cat doing? And all of this kind of stuff. Well, now there's so many YouTube videos, you can bypass all of that trial and error and go and watch these videos. And then you're like, oh, so that's what this button does.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, precisely. This is a 4-track recorder. Oh, this is an 8-track recorder. It can record all these different audio. Wow, it can do all of this stuff.
Yeah.
And
even
you have
your
no
phone.
Clue.
You're walking around with a high definition recorder in your phone, you know?
Yeah. Most phones have a 20, 30 megapixel camera on them and a 1080 or even a 4K, some of them, video recorder. And I mean, it's like you're walking around every day with this high tech recording device in your hand, and we're playing Candy Crush.
Yeah, exactly. So there is a whole world out there of technology at your disposal, even right there in your own cabinet, stuff like that. It's about treating things properly and getting things ready and making sure that you are ready when you get out in the field.
And trail cameras. I mean, my goodness, when I first started out, trail cameras were so ridiculously expensive.
Yeah.
Because you had to go and buy an actual camera, and then you put the camera inside of a little box, and that box actually had a plunger that pushed the button on the camera, and it was just ridiculous. And then we went to trail cameras that had really slow trigger speeds and had actual flashes on them and things like that. And it was horrible. Now, for $29, you can go to any hunting store and get a, you know,
pretty decent trail cam.
15 to 20 megapixel camera with a half second trigger speed that has night vision, infrared night vision on it with no flash and all of this kind of stuff. And, you know, you can get them for less than $30.
Yeah. Yeah. It's phenomenal.
Or like now, I mean, some of them that I have now are cell phone. They send pictures directly. As soon as they take a picture, it's sent to my phone.
Yep.
For less than $70.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy. It's crazy.
And cost me $15 a month for unlimited amount of pictures.
Yeah.
So, with my camera setup that I have now, the camera I think was like, I gave $62 for it. I have a solar charger that was about $30, a 12 volt battery that hooks to the solar charger and everything and then to the camera, that was about $25, and then all the cables probably another $20-$25.
Yeah,
so you know, I've probably got $150 in the camera setup, but you can leave it out all year long.
Yeah,
year round. You won't have to go back and touch it.
Yep.
Unless it quits sending pictures.
Yeah,
you know, but you it, you literally can leave it out.
Yeah,
and
it is no longer prohibitively expensive.
Right, and you don't have to go keep putting your cent to go change SD cards.
Yeah,
and bring it back home. Everyone, you can leave these out, especially if you have private property that you're not worried about anybody coming and stealing it. You know, you can leave it out year round.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. Precisely. There is a world of technology at our disposal now for amazing, amazing deals that was once never available to the common person. So the panoply of options is out there for folks. Jeff, thank you so much for taking the time coming on. We need to have you on more regularly to talk about this kind of stuff, because once again, my show is about trying to demystify things for folks, you know, and I see a lot of shows, out there talking about get out there in the field, get out there and do it. But are you prepared to go out and do it? You know, like I'm,
that's the thing. Don't be,
I've spent the better part of my life dragging gear around, you know? So it's one of those, like, there's something to dragging that around, and there's a method to that madness, and there's a method to getting down to what you need, but still having what you need, you know? So yeah, that can take some time to perfect and figure out exactly what kit works right for you and which technology you can be familiar with. You know,
exactly. And it doesn't matter if somebody is 15 years old, 10 years old, if they're interested in it and you're their parent, go spend time with those kids.
Get into it. Get into
it. Nothing. There's no stigma to Bigfoot hunting. It's not crazy people. It's if you get out there with your preteen or teenager and put these trail cameras out and go spend time with those kids. How awesome is that? You're spending time with those kids out in the woods. If it's your dad, your grandpa, your grandma, your brother, your sister, your best friend, or even a total flipping stranger that you met on some crazy Facebook group, go spend some time in the woods. Some of the best friends.
Maybe not that with the I've crazy stranger.
Hey, some of the best friends that I have made in the past 10 years have been what we like to kid each other and say these crazy Bigfoot people.
Oh, yeah.
Because we all go out, we sit around a campfire, we cook, we eat, we listen to music, we do whatever. Then we go out in the woods and we put trail cameras out and we look for tracks and we walk up and down the creeks and we go and we have fun.
Yeah.
And nobody's at a bar. Which I ain't saying there's nothing wrong with that, but what I'm saying is nobody's getting hurt. Nobody's there's nothing.
Nobody's
bad.
Out digging up trouble or getting into trouble or anything like that.
Exactly. Yeah. I've been to literally hundreds of these Bigfoot campouts, and I've never seen a fight.
Yep.
Had a couple of arguments about Bigfoot techniques and things like that, but they're just fun spirited.
Woo versus woo, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, but I mean, it's all in good spirit and it's all fun.
Yeah.
So get out there, get a trail camera, start out with one stinking trail camera and go put it out somewhere and have fun looking at the squirrels and the rabbits and the deer and everything. And if you don't get a picture of Bigfoot, hey, great. You got a picture of a bunch of other stuff. But get you a second camera and a third camera and a fourth camera. And the next thing you know, you've got a duffel bag full of cameras. You're out there asking the neighbor, hey, you've got 20 acres. Can I go put my cameras out? And you're having fun and enjoy yourself.
Exactly. So, tell everybody where they can go to follow your work, where they can go to keep up with everything that is Crypto Hawk. And, all that kind of good stuff, bud.
Well, if everybody can go to, I guess you can just go to Amazon or places like that. You can pick up Texas Jack's Wild Game and Venison Cookbook. That's me. I'm part of the Texas Jack crew. I wrote that cookbook. Also, Wood Knox series of books with David Weatherly. I was one of the co-authors of volumes 2 and 4. My goodness, they can find me. I have the Facebook group Monsters, Mysteries, and Mayhem on Facebook. They could find Survivor Man, Bigfoot, Texas episode, Finding Bigfoot, Best Little Bigfoot in Texas, that episode, that's all on YouTube. Oh my goodness, Expedition Texas, I have episodes of that. My goodness, just Monsters and Mysteries in America, the Sabine Thing episode is mine. They can check that out also on several different streaming platforms. And also the movies Something in the Woods and Man vs. Bigfoot. I had a hand in those two movies and actually have an acting role, and I was the assistant director and special effects artist on Man vs. Bigfoot.
Yeah, that's right. Well, man, thanks so much for everything. Thanks so much for coming on. I always love our conversations whenever I see you at conferences, all that kind of good stuff.
Enjoy it, man. I love talking.
Same here, bud. We will definitely have you on again soon. I'll be sending links to this, everything else. I guess thanks so much for being on tonight.
It was my pleasure, my friend. My pleasure.
Absolutely. Well, we'll go ahead and let you go as we say goodbye to our audience for this segment and bump out to commercial break. Thanks so much again for coming on, and we'll be in touch, Jeff.
Everybody have a good evening.
All right. Take care, bud. While you are online checking out all of the awesome work from Jeff Crypto Hulk Stewart, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can go and find our store. That's where you can get all of the books, movies, films, things like that from our guests. That is also where you can find us on social media, all of our social media icons. Follow, like, subscribe, everything else. You can visit our videos page and check out all of the embedded video channels from our guest YouTubes. So stop on by and check that out at curiousrealm.com/video. Stay tuned through this commercial break, folks. We will be coming right back with our friend Chester Moore to discuss the Smiley Face Killers and the possible relation to those cases across America with the cases here in Rainy Street, known as the Rainy Street Murders, coming up right after this. Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to this segment. Our guest this evening is an amazing researcher, not just in the field of wildlife for Texas Parks and Wildlife. He has an amazing ministry out there called Higher Calling, where he helps kids, all kinds of stuff, get out into the wild, learn to experience the wild, not to be afraid of wild animals, things like that. And from that work, he has created a now award-winning podcast, Dark Outdoors, which explores, well, the dark side of being outdoors, going out places like our state parks, national parks, just going out and roughing it on your own like you used to be able to at one point, is not as safe as it used to be. And his coverage for this in the world of media has been recognized by the Texas Press Club, all kinds of things, winning awards over major news outlets, all kinds of stuff for his coverage in this area. We'll be talking about the Smiley Face Killers this evening and their relation to the Rainy Street Murders here in Austin. Welcome to the show, our good friend Chester Moore. How you doing, bud?
Hey, man, great to be on your program. It's always an honor and privilege, and you always ask good questions, so I'll never know Thank where you. We're going to end up here.
Well, man, last time I saw you, it was Falk Monster Fest, actually, yep. Was the yep. last time, and that was quite a few months ago, so I'm glad to be looping back around and yes, hitting you quite literally after you won the award. How did that come about? That is, so like I said, really awesome.
The Press Club of Southeast Texas does annual excellence in media awards. And you got to realize I've been so blessed to win a lot of awards in the wildlife outdoors realm. And I you know what? I'm going to join the press club. They're such a prestigious organization.
That's awesome.
And I'm going to enter some of my stuff and won a bunch of stuff. And I won overall podcast excellence for Dark Outdoors. And I also won best investigative program for the show I did last year on the horse killings in Texas.
Yeah, and we have had quite the train over the last year of just strange, weird things going on. Like right as we were together last was when the cattle mutilations started up in Texas. And that got to the point where the local sheriffs were like, we are beyond bamboozled, locals. If you have information, like that blew my mind that they went to social media.
I could not. That was what really got me on that one. And of course, once that happened, I don't think they were prepared for the avalanche of inquiries and reports.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get them on the phone, but I talked to a local Fox affiliate who couldn't get them on the phone either after that. And, you know, and it's funny because out of that program that me and my friend Jeff Stewart did about the cattle mutilations, people are still downloading that show. I just talked with a guy 2 days ago in Oregon who owns 6,000 acres and had a cattle mutilation on his property in the middle of nowhere in Oregon last weekend.
Wow.
So a lot of crazy stuff going on. And just when I think I'm going to get to take a break from investigating, something else pops up. We got to jump into.
Well, and we were just talking before we hit record and everything. Just so you're aware, Crypto Hulk was the guest just before your segment here. So
perfect. I love Jeff. He's a great guy.
He's great. Whenever I get to hang out with you guys at conferences, it's always awesome conversation on the side. Yep. You guys both do amazing work in the field of field research and being hip deep in it. And once again, Dark Outdoors came to you through your work for Texas Parks and Wildlife. You have numerous books. Like I'm the owner of Texas Waterfowl, Texas Trout Guide.
Texas Fishing Game, not Texas Parks and Wildlife. I don't work for
Texas
the state.
Texas Fishing Game, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Sorry. I don't work for the state. Correct. I don't think the state would hire me, but
I think they would.
I actually did a lot of freelance work for them back in my college days.
You've literally written the book on numerous things regarding specific wildlife stuff here in the state of Texas. So
it's a great way you set that up, because in the context of just going to enjoy outdoor pursuits and get information for people, I kept finding myself in weird situations, dangerous situations. And it kind of like went to a head when I released my hog book. You know, couple of years to release my hog book, I had a lot of speaking engagements that were brought to me about hogs. And at the end, I did a Q&A at one of them. And someone said, "Hey, Chester, what is the most dangerous thing in the woods?" And I know they thought I was about to say a hog or a grizzly or a rattlesnake. And without even blinking, I said people.
Yeah.
And the conversation got interesting. And then on my radio program I do on News Talk 560 KLVI and More Outdoors, a little while after that, I just told one of my stories of an encounter in the wild where I almost didn't make it home and at the human hands, and the phones lit up and I couldn't take all the calls. So I had to figure out how to make a media platform out of this, but preserve some investigative integrity. So we just do seasons of the program. Yeah. I might put out 15 episodes a year, because it's so in depth of what it takes to put this stuff out. And it's not normal true crime. I don't want to know why some nut job fantasized about cutting someone's head off. I don't care. I don't want to know that detail. I want to know how they got caught. I want to know why more of these people aren't getting caught, and how people can read these signs to stay alive in the outdoors, you know, in my realm. Because, you know, it's interesting, you know, back in the 80s, like a lot of the horror movies were set in the woods, right? That was the scary place to go. And then it came kind of back to like, you know, Freddy Krueger comes and it's in your house and it's in your dreams.
Yeah.
And, you know, you kind of had that as a pop culture thing, and the cities became, you know, quite dangerous. But we're getting to the point now where predators have realized, and I'm talking human predators, we also talk about wildlife predators on my program as well. But they realize that there's this big interest in camping, hunting, fishing, wildlife, and they can do their evil deeds in places where people least expect it, and they have less chance of being caught. And those are the places I like to go fly fish, and people like to camp. People like to go with their families. And so that's what Dark Outdoors is about. And I tell you what, brother, when I started the program, I thought, you know, it'll get over. It'll be successful. It's a good topic. And hopefully it'll save some lives. But I had no idea the response in terms of feedback and stories and people sharing things. And, you know, the smiley face thing popping up is one case, because in season one of Dark Outdoors in 2022, me and my friend William Ramsey of William Ramsey Investigates, we talked about the smiley, because William's done two documentaries on this. And then in season two, I wasn't going to do a smiley face killers one. I already did one. And then the thing in Rainy Street and Lady Bird Lake popped up in Austin. And I'm like, it's in my backyard now, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, this was something that popped up a while back from different drummer about the connection between the two and seeing a smiley face. And before we get into all of that, what was your experience once again, you lived a life outdoors, you work outdoors, all kinds of things. But what was that experience that really steeled you in this way and put you down a different path of trying to educate people, Chester?
Well, there were a couple, but the one that was like when I shared it, you know, 10 years later after it happened and shared it, that the shockwaves went through all my listeners and I got more feedback than I've ever gotten on anything was me and my dad were in Humboldt County, California.
Oh, God.
In 2002, I had just realized my dream of shark cage diving with great whites out of San Francisco.
Too cool.
And my dad didn't go on that, but he went to the trip with me, and we wanted to go see the redwoods. And being people that were into cryptozoology, we wanted to go up to Willow Creek area and all that of California. And we talked to some locals, and he said, look, there's a great, you know, I had just gotten Generation 3 night vision goggles, and we had like audio recording stuff. He goes, look, there's been a lot of reports and things up in this one area, and the Thule elk are rutting. And at night up there, you're going to hear this chorus of elk bugles, this beautiful. So we went up there, going to camp out till probably midnight or so and go drive back 50 miles where we're staying, a little lodge. And we went up to the top of this mountain. We're probably up at about 7,000 feet. And the top of the mountain had a road that went on both sides of the mountain. We took the left side where we're told to drive about a quarter mile down and park. And on this logging road, and there's the valley. And, you know, you could see, we actually saw elk when we got there right before dark, and we can hear them bugling. It was really cool.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there, it had just gotten dark, and I'm looking through my night vision goggles, and I see a light beam coming right up the rim of the canyon from us, like right up to us. And I'm going, my God, Dad, somebody's got a light shining at us. And I pulled my goggles off, and there was no light. And Dad goes, I don't see a light. I said, whoa, they must have shut it off. I put the goggles back on, and now the light was going down where I could see a trail, but it was going. And I said, now I see a light. And he goes, no. And he goes, I don't see a light. And I look and pull the goggles off, and there's no light. And it clicked. Someone had infrared goggles and an infrared light down there, and they probably weren't looking for elk.
Yeah.
Because I've been told about drug trade in the area. But we have it in Texas, too.
The Emerald Triangle. There is.
Yeah, I had no idea of that.
Yeah, there is right there. Bam.
Yep. That's, brother, let me tell you something. We learned about it.
That is frightening, dude. That's frightening.
Well, it gets worse. So I said, Dad, we got to go. We had rented a little SUV, you know, for the trip. And we threw everything we had in. And in 2 minutes, we're headed out there. I turned the lights of the car on. And down the other logging road across the mountain road, about maybe a half mile away, I see lights turn on of a vehicle.
Oh.
So I knew someone down on the bottom signaled someone over there. And so we jetted out of there, and this vehicle's coming at us. I hit the main road down the mountain probably 5 to 7 seconds before the other vehicle did. And this is the first time I'd really driven in mountains. You know, I'm from 14 feet elevation on the Texas coast, you know?
Yeah.
And I was going 75 to 80 down that mountain to keep them off of us. And they were trying to ram us at one point. when they were trying to push us. They got on the other side and trying to push us off the mountain. And I knew we had encountered drug trade right then. And we got to the base of this highway, which was in the middle of nowhere, literally. And we turned to go back west. And then they turned back around and went the other direction. And I immediately called the Forest Service the next morning. And they said, oh, that was drug runners. You're lucky you're alive.
Yeah.
And when I shared that story, because literally, if we had not gotten out, if we had not listened to our gut and left, we probably would have been killed right then.
Yeah.
You know, and it, because they were literally trying to push us off. I've never been, you know, so that I shared that one and that really resonated. So that's what really got me going. And then the other things have happened, but that's the one that went, you know, when I told the story on the air, I literally couldn't get to all the calls. And then the emails kept coming and I went, there's something to this. It's resonating. And if this is happening to other people, we need to start covering this journalistically to save some lives.
And now, here in Texas, let's move this experience to Texas, because that is where a lot of your work has happened. Things like you've done animal counts for wildlife departments all over the country, elk, all kinds of things. But at what point did you start seeing these issues popping up more and more in the forests of Texas, specifically in the suburban forests of Texas?
Well,
because I was a kid that grew up in West Houston, man. I'd go out and hit Buffalo Bayou, all kinds of things. I don't know that I would go walk Buffalo Bayou the way I used to, like snake hunting and stuff.
Well,
I'll tell you what,
it's changed the way I look at all this stuff. What happened was I kind of immediately started seeing things a little differently, if that makes any sense. And
absolutely.
And there's this one barrier island here, and there's great fishing there. And I was doing some wildlife research there, and there was a body found there. This is around the same time of incident in California. Unfortunately, it was the body of Denaria Finley, a beautiful little 3-year-old girl taken from her home.
Yep.
In Orange, Texas, where I live, and deposited on this island in Port Arthur, Texas, where everybody in our community goes to fish on the weekends, you know?
Yep.
And it's in an area I fished in 100 times. And that right there, still unfortunately an unsolved case. And then other things really made me click to that. And then you start looking at some of the history of some of these areas out here and some of the bizarre things that have gone on and the missing people. And I started seeing missing people in headlines in the Piney Woods, for example.
Mm.
And a lot of those people are still missing 10, 15 years later, you know, and there's no resolution to the case. And I knew that there was something going on. There was a change culturally for the dark side. Mm. And it was really the Denaria Finley case. And then the aftermath of all that, and then just some things I had in the same general area before were like, you know, I come out of this, I was doing a red wolf research project, and I came out of this marsh, and there were two guys with a prostitute on top of a car right next to my car.
Oh, God.
Broad daylight. And, you know, I won't go into details, of course. And you know, I left and I'm like, got out of Dodge, and I'm thinking, I hope this poor lady lives. You know what I mean? It was so insidious. And I'm like, if people are getting this bold, like there's a dozen places they could have pulled over other than by my vehicle. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And just stuff like that, you would see that was real criminal. And you brought up something. It's dangerous in the backcountry, but it's these kind of suburban forests that are probably the most dangerous areas of all.
Yeah.
And it really even goes back to the 1946 Moonlight murders in Texarkana, where the Phantom Killer went to Lover's Lanes, and it translated into the Zodiac Killer and stuff like that. And creating these crimes of recognition. There's a guy that I think is a Zodiac Killer. I'm going to do a podcast about this. His name is Edward Wayne Edwards. I think he's as high a candidate. He's a proven, convicted double Lover's Lane murderer. wanted, the most wanted man in America, 1960, for a Lover's Lane murder, that he, the police found him at the scene looking at the body. And anyway, he wrote a book called, and he was supposedly a traveling the country as a reformed criminal. And he talked about, I like to create crimes of recognition growing up. So I could sit back and watch the newspaper respond to a bank robbery or whatever it was. And I'm not identified, but my crimes live on. And I think that even translates now to this smiley face killers thing.
Sure.
Because once Ganim and the other guys, the original police in New York, who kind of were the pioneers of this, and guys like William Ramsey got involved, people knew of the MO. And now it's iconic. And I think it's going to be a lot harder for these people to get away with it. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing in Austin. It's like all these deaths and it kind of stops, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But the MO is out there and it's a symbol, an icon now that is terrifying people. And it's happening. And the reason, you know, you might look at the smiley face killers thing because they usually come out of a bar and disappear. Mm-hmm. And think that's not outdoors related, but all the bodies are dumped in a lake or a river. And I said, I have to start looking at this because we fishermen are the most likely to see a body dump. We're the ones that are most likely to find the body dump. And especially guys like me, like to night fish or find little places in the middle of nowhere.
Lady Bird Lake with all of the early, there's sculling crews that go through there early in the morning. There's, you know, people going out on their kayaks all day.
Yeah.
All kinds of things. And
so that was my gateway into getting into this because I'm like, hold on, this is my domain. This is the great outdoors and a fisherman could be the key eyewitness or, you know, if this is a group of people, if there's more than one, especially, and you're the guy who looks over and they don't know that you're over there on the side of the bank been catfishing all night or gar fishing or whatever, and they see you, maybe you become a victim, you know? Yeah. So those are things that brought me into this one. Like, I'm not going to do, you know, some serial killer who invites people to his house and chops them up. That's not what we do in dark outdoors. Yeah. But this is almost in your face at, like, the Lady Bird Lake thing. And let's say this. We cannot prove it's the smiley face killers.
We can't. But and that's because the smiley face killers have never been proven.
Never.
I remember first hearing about the smiley face killer case on Coast to Coast AM, like back in 2003, something like that.
Yeah.
And it was the investigators from New York who had just gotten together and connected their cases with cases in Washington.
Yeah. And what it was, they were like, they had these bizarro cases that they just couldn't shake the fact that, like, they've been gone for 6 weeks and the coroner said they've been in the water for 48 hours.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of stuff. And then they see these other cases and it kind of goes in, like, it's almost like when you talk about a Bigfoot flap or a UFO flap of a bunch of encounters or whatever. Well, that's kind of what this is like, that there are areas that seem to get hit and then it moves on and maybe comes back. And the one case that got me into going, I definitely got this, was the Todd Guide case, which was he left a party in basically a cornfield, you know, in a rural area, and they found him in a guy's lake. And for him to get to that lake and happen to just be so drunk he'd fall in and drown was so preposterous. And then they did tests on the body and things like that. And that's it, the feet washing up.
Yeah,
I mean,
this was one that was happening right at the same time as the smiley face killings, and they didn't know if it was connected or what, but they were like, feet keep washing up, and they've continued washing up. It's been
weird. It's like, well, nothing weird here. There are feet showing up on the beach. Nothing strange see. Don't ask crazy, questions.
Just a foot. And once again, I loved your hypothesis that this is a dark web phenomena. Mm-hmm. There has been a long held theory out there, I guess really more hypothesis than theory.
Yeah.
Long held hypothesis of the fact that many possible string serial killings that have ties across the country might be like truckers.
Yeah.
Someone like that who has a transient lifestyle that runs across a route, but you may not catch them for years and years and years because they kill like two people in a state. And then
the jurisdictions
change.
Are
found in another state.
And the jurisdictions change.
Yeah.
And there's something that you and I talked about with the cattle mutilations, I think, that needs to be looked at when it comes into serial killings.
Please.
So when America first really got introduced probably to serial killings was probably the Ted Bundy case. I mean, that's when it became like this known thing, this monster who had did all this reign of terror from Washington down to Florida, right?
Mm-hmm.
But so people who are in a true crime can rattle off this, this, and this marker and this. Now, because of the internet and history, these evil people who want to do these things now have the luxury of being able to back engineer killings. So
yeah,
they can go, well, typical MO of a serial killer is to use the same method. I'm going to use a different method every time.
Yeah.
Or I'm going to change it up to break the whatever, or I'm going to crawl across a jurisdiction. No one thought of that back in the 70s, but now these people have the unfortunate luxury being able to do things like that to evade people. And with the smiley face killer phenomenon, for those who don't know, it's where young men, typically young men, are between like 20 and 30, are found and they disappear mainly, usually from a nightclub or a party. They are sometimes seen maybe having a couple of drinks, but leaving like completely obliterated, like they were spiked in a drink or something. They disappear. Maybe they're found 3 weeks later in a body of water. They're ruled a drowning because they're in a body of water. But the coroner says they've been in the water 24 hours, 72 yeah. hours, not 21 days. So where were they for the last 18 days? You know, very bizarre stuff. And, you know, you've had bodies move dozens of miles from where the person was supposedly went in the water at and all kind of stuff. So different people have hypothesized that it's something like William Ramsey mentioned, a traded on the dark web. And that makes the most sense. Like an MO, like this is something. It's like it may be a killer doing one in one city and the other guy and his buddies over here doing something in another city.
Yep.
But it all falls into the same category and causes massive
a snuff
fear.
Club. So to speak, like a dark web snuff
club. It almost reminds me of that movie 8mm with Nicolas Cage.
Yeah,
and that kind of thing.
And I now, granted, traveling across the country like I have, things like that is one thing that I have thought about more than once. Is my God, how easy would that be to be somebody who does that transiently? And to be able to just go and somebody random in every city. And yes, if sharing an MO, one of the things that I watch regularly on the road, is how to catch a smuggler.
Yeah.
On Nat Geo. It'll just be something that I have on in the background.
Yeah.
And regularly whenever I am watching that, like, it'll be some dude that has like a pretty complex method and they'll ask him like, wow, how'd you get to this point? And he's like, well, you know, I watched a lot of shows like this and that kind of stuff and just kind of saw what not to do. Like,
see, like I said, kind of back engineering.
Like Dexter, watching shows like CSI, you know, that kind of stuff where it's like, oh, well, that's how they catch him, you know. So
now I'll avoid X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
So they just, I don't get caught. It's kind of, I think, the mentality of some of these people. And there, with this particular thing, you know, this came really into the consciousness after, like, there was a body found in February in Lady Bird Lake, and then one in March, I think it was the 3rd, and then April 1st, April 15th.
Yeah.
And there was one found in June. There was four, like, bam, bam, bam. You know, it was like a bunch. And there was one actually back in 2022 as well. I think it was in December that's kind of affiliated with this. And then there was one found June 27th. So later on, and of course they're all ruled drownings because they were found in the water.
Yeah.
And my thing is this.
Yeah. Eight dead bodies.
Yeah. And it goes back years because there are families from a few years back. I'm just talking about the recent flap that say, hey, my relative was not drowning by falling in the stupid water. Yeah. Something else happened. But four, and then we had the fifth one happen in June, and the one back in 2022, and then go back further. And it's all this area. And my question is this, and I'm not a genius. I'm not the greatest investigator in the world, but I'm fairly intelligent. There are people getting hammered every single night in Austin at nightclubs near Lady Bird Lake.
Right next to it. I mean, it's called the Rainy Street Murders because it happened on Rainy Street. Like, everybody was pretty much last seen partying on Rainy Street. A street that is within two blocks.
Yeah, it's right there by Lady Bird Lake. And then for these to happen all of a sudden in the same kind of situation. But it brings up something interesting. I don't have the ages in front of me. But for smiley face killer stuff, it's a little off on ages, a little older than some of the typical smiley face killer demographic has been, because most of that's been 18, like 20 to 30, really, but 18 to 30. Yeah. These are a little bit older, a couple of them. But once again, I asked a question. Has someone said, you know what, I'm going to throw him a curveball by getting a 45-year-old guy or a little bit older? I don't know. But and then what gets me, if it's all this partying and this is, you know, in the winter part of it, and it's all of this, how come there just aren't people dropping dead every week or every month in the lake at Lady Bird Lake?
Yeah.
What was different about this time frame is what we really have to ask, because it fits the profile. And there was one gentleman, last place he was seen was at a food truck, you know, and disappears from a group. And that seems to be something that these people do, is they like to find someone that's in a group and wanders off from the group and, like, you know, kind of isolates themselves and makes themselves, you know, available. And one of the things I think is involved, and I have no doubt about, I'm not saying even in this Rainy Street in particular, but there have to be people in nightclubs involved in this. There have to be some people, waiters, owners, somebody, security, that is somehow involved, because there's nightclubs tied into all of this stuff. And,
is part of the profile of the cases, is that they were all, like we were saying, they were all pretty much last seen in a bar.
Now, there are a few on the East Coast that are like red, like one of them was at a basketball game, and there's things like that. But these ones were down centered in that party district of Austin, you know, and pretty much were having a good time with their friends or whatever. And so I think, In some of these cases, that definitely there's someone on the inside somewhere that's involved. There's even been theories that some of these cases in the past have involved traveling musicians who are playing clubs at some of these things, and they're traveling, and that would be a easy way to get in and out and not be suspect if you're the traveling band, if you're a member of a band or things like that. So those are just things that need to be. And one of the things I really want to get across is this. Look, man, I've been clean sober my whole life. I never partied. That wasn't my thing. If it is, that's fine. It's fine. Yeah. I don't, you know, but be smart, please. If you're going out, don't go alone.
Yep.
Don't go with someone who's going to get more messed up than you. And be very careful of who approaches you, you know, and their level of interest in you. Well, that's something.
Even things like don't make yourself a target. Like Austin is what I work in, as you know, as most of my audience knows, I work in the live event industry. Like I work in corporate AV and convention centers all over the country. The number of people, Austin, Texas is one of the only convention centers I've seen that has signs on your way out the door that says remove your conference name badge. How many conferences do you see where it's like 10,000 people leaving the place with a bag of swag, their purse, a name badge? That means you are not from town. You have disposable income and a whole bunch of treats in your bag.
Yeah.
Like you have made yourself a target.
That's a great point.
Straight up.
That's a great point. Yeah.
And it is that situational awareness, you know, and like going out into the wilderness. Like, have you told somebody the direction you're heading? Have you given them a waypoint? Like, hey, if I don't contact you in 4 hours, call me.
You know, and that's a great point, because I always recommend this in the outdoors, even just for getting injured in the middle of nowhere purposes. Mm. you know, like always say, have a game plan. Let at least two people know where you're going to go and what time you expect to be home and when to call the cavalry. Right. Yeah.
Hey, my mom used to say that, like, let me know where you're, which direction you're headed and what time to expect you. So I know which way to send the cops if you don't come home.
Yeah. And, you know, it goes back. I remember, you know, you talk about situational awareness and like the party districts and your name tag and all this and being aware. I mean, we, my band, Freak 13.
Man. People are going out and drinking with their freaking name tags on and stuff like
that. Yeah, so somebody's already got the name. Somebody's already got their social media profile, where they live, their GPS.
Yeah.
If they're single,
Lord,
married.
Man, some of those things have a freaking QR where it's like, shoot it, get my LinkedIn. Like,
yeah.
I could be getting
your
phone number, all kinds of things.
Yeah, it's getting too personal, man. I remember back when my band Freak 13 I had back in the early 2000s, we played New Orleans quite a bit because it's only 4 hours from us over here in Orange, where I live. And we have a friend of mine from California, and man, she looked like a penthouse pet. I've never seen anyone ever get attention from guys when they walk by. It was like the Moses parting the Red Sea. So we were at a club. And they were all getting hammered. I was the designated driver, a place down in Bourbon Street area at like 2 o'clock in the morning, and it was Mardi Gras time. And
she decided
she decided she wanted to go walk the streets to walk it off by herself.
Ooh.
And I said, girl, I wouldn't let a guy friend of mine do this, much less someone who at the time was like 24 and looks like you. There's no flipping. Yeah. I thought she was going to physically fight me because she was hammered. But I said, I'm going with you. I'll walk outside. There's no way. Yeah. So you have to have that situation. And also, and that's the other thing I want to bring up with that story. Be very vigilant with your friends. Mm. Don't let them go off alone when they've had too much to drink, too much to smoke, whatever situation they're in. Follow them, be with them. If they want to fight with
you, if they're being responsible and catching a lift, wait outside with them.
Yeah.
You know, make sure they
don't let them go by themselves, because that could end up in tragedy and things like this.
Yeah,
and,
man.
You know, when you look at the Austin and the LinkedIn smiley face killers, I mean, almost every marker is there. Not every set of cases is the same, but Austin is a perfect city for this. Because I believe it's a media hub now.
Yeah.
It is a growing city. It's a governmental city. And I think part of this is going back to that Ed Edwards thing, which is creating crimes of recognition now.
Mm.
My crime lives on while I'm in the shadows back here. And creating this terror that goes beyond the crime itself and just keeps living on.
Well, even your connection that you made in the presentation at Falk with which was so well done, and the connection of serial killings across the country, specifically Lover's Lane killings, things like that, and public parks. Because and to connect these things together, part of the MO with the smiley face killers is people of alternative lifestyle. And that goes right along with the Lover's Lane thing.
The Lover's Lane thing is, you know, that's kind of almost a cliche now because you see it in horror movies and everything like that. But it started
since you after that.
Yes.
Was the Zodiac, the image of the Zodiac killer's signature, his signature image.
Yep.
And the connection with the zodiacal image for Earth.
It's
the
exact
same image. The exact same image.
You know, whoever this guy was knew a lot of esoteric stuff, you know, but even going before him, the Phantom Killer of Texarkana, never officially thing. Created a media sensation at the time. It was on every radio program in America. It was on Time Magazine back then, New York Times, and his crimes are getting recognized. He's striking terror in areas where people are going to enjoy themselves. And I think I might have told this story, but I knew about that case, of course, from the movie, the Charles B. Pierce movie, The Town of the Dreaded Sundown.
Mm-hmm.
And Dark Outdoors has my favorite podcast I did was on The Town of the Dreaded Sundown and the Phantom Killer guy.
It's a great movie. Great movie.
But I remember being terrified. And I remember me and my now wife, then girlfriend, going parking And brother, here is hormonal filled 17-year-old
like
me.
That's going swimming at night after watching Jaws, guy.
Yeah, it like, wasn't the same night. It wasn't the same night, but I've seen the movie recently, and we go to park, and I remember this like it was yesterday. Click my seatbelt off. She clicks hers off. I kiss her as far as I got, and all of a sudden, there's a heavy-handed knock on the window. And in my mind, I was going to turn around. There's going to be a guy in a white hood.
See a guy in a sack mask.
I'm dead. It's over. And I look, and it's a cop. And I went, oh, crap, is it a real cop? Even at 17, I'm like, is it a real cop?
Yeah.
And I roll the window down. He goes, son, you and your girlfriend there might want to go talk somewhere else. A little dangerous over here. So I sped out of there like a bat out of hell. And that shot the mood for the night. That was it. It was that idea of creating terror. So think about this.
Yeah.
Because that guy did that in 1946, there was a movie. I thought of that in that moment in like 1991.
Yeah.
And you know, so
that's what they mean by crime of recognition. Is it? It's something that. And if you think about that, if you think about the idea of the smiley face killers being not a person or even two people working together or moving around, but an MO that is passed along, through a thread, through some dark webs or Tor means, something like that. That really sets up for a much greater crime of recognition amongst the group, which is a bigger thrill for everybody involved.
Yeah, it's like they're getting over with their evil buddies.
Yeah, well, it's you get to get off on your buddies killing.
Yeah, and it's like, hey, this guy did this in Texas, like, and we're doing it in Washington or Chicago.
I get this second Thursday off. You know, I get to see what Bobby's doing this month.
There's international. When William Ramsey's second documentary talked a lot about the international type of things like this, and there have been some people arrested for other related type crimes that could have been involved in some of these. They just didn't fess up to, that were involved in attacking young men. But it's still a great mystery, and it is a point to talk about just situational awareness. The other thing that concerns me about this coming into Texas, okay, is it's almost like it's testing the waters. Like, okay, we did this. We hadn't got caught. There's a lot of media stuff. We created a frenzy. But we got plenty of metro areas here in Texas, and there's even evidence of a similar killing in Houston. That ended up and that'll end up being on another program. I'm currently working on some things on that one that was before these. And I think it was in 2021, 2022, that was very similar, but ended up in the Houston Ship Channel, the person. And it's very similar. So it's almost like testing the waters and of where they can go with this. And Austin is, there's probably more dumb young people in Austin, just because it's a party place. Everybody's wanting to go have a good time.
It's
they don't
college
go to school.
Town.
People don't go to school in Austin typically just because it's the greatest education. A lot of them go because it's a fun place.
Yeah.
And so that element of it makes people feel invincible. I always grew up thinking I was like going to be the next slasher victim. So I was the opposite of that. And it probably served me well, but a lot of people just think, hey, we're going to go have a good time, have a few drinks, and then this some kind of a horror ends up happening. And the greater idea you brought up of the serial killers traveling things, and I did the episode from this season that probably shocked the most people was the one I did about the Sam Houston National Forest and the body in the barrel and all of the missing people that were part of this, that were part of all of this. And, the Sam Houston National Forest has a lot of missing people around the corridor, right?
Yeah.
And I think that one of the things that people were thinking is probably some kind of a killer. There's been a lot of John Does and Jane Does. And then they end up finding a body in a barrel. A guy lives across the street from it. And this guy and his brother kidnapped and raped three women in the late 70s.
Wow.
The guy was a juvenile and was killing and raping. He got like wrist slapped, went to juvie. He's been out all of his time. He lives across the street from San Houston National Forest. There is a body in the barrel at his house. Could that possibly be connected to disappearing people? It was worth asking questions about, but what I think the bigger thing you and I have talked about, and there's a theme kind of hidden here, is how come officials aren't making more connections to some of these things?
Yeah.
I don't get why, like, no, we shouldn't be suspicious of this guy who kidnapped and raped three women when he was 17 with his 20-year-old brother and living on the edge of the air with a lot of John Does, Jane Does, and missing people. He couldn't be a suspect. So I think there's some of that to where, like, there's almost a blindness in law enforcement.
Yeah, yeah. And I think also sometimes, Chester, there is a want to just wrap it up.
Yeah, yep.
You know, and I hate saying that. I hate saying that. A want to wrap it up as quickly as possible.
Sure.
You know?
Yep. And it goes back to jurisdictional things. If this thing happened in Jefferson County or Cameron County, and then it happens over here in Harris County.
That's just it. Yeah.
Then you got all these. So I think at some point, I think, because there are a lot of good law enforcement people doing a lot of hard work.
There are.
And I think at some point, there will probably be more streamlined approach to finding some of this stuff. And we'll get some closure on some of this.
And it is another fact of the matter that I keep bringing it up in so many topics, whether it's Bigfoot research, man, whether it's UFO, UAP research. I keep saying I cannot wait until we unleash the power of AI in the MUFON archives. But once you start releasing the power of AI into investigations like this, and unsolved cases across the country, brother, the connections that we're going to find that we would have, departments would have never cross-found are going to be amazing.
And then we get the Terminator, so I don't know.
Well, now, granted, as long as we keep feeding them what we have on the internet, I think we'll keep them pretty stupid, Chester.
I'm just of the Terminator generation, so I have thoughts like this.
Oh, same here. Like Skynet all the way. But once again, they're learning of what we have on the internet.
True.
So
very much so. Very much so.
I think they'll be just as stupid as the next.
I love it.
I hold hope for the fact that it will be just as generally stupid as mankind because of the internet information it is absorbing.
Yeah, it depends on who they absorb. I know a few folks, if they get absorbed, it's going to be a negative AI.
Oh,
you know,
God,
it's going to be a null and void.
It'll be.
I think most of them are in office somewhere. But
being able to leverage that technology and investigations like this to be able to really fine tooth comb with that is going to be amazing.
Especially in things like composite photos, eyewitnesses. I mean, I truly believe that that Jeffrey Dahmer actually killed Adam Walsh in 1981. Mm. If you look at that case, because the composite Dahmer lived 20 minutes from where Adam Walsh was that year.
Yeah.
And, collected heads. He was seen at the mall the day before and the day of by this composite didn't look like Otis Toole. It looked like Jeffrey Dahmer, and nobody knew until 1991 who Jeffrey Dahmer was. What I'm saying is technology could help with some of these composites and things like that, narrowing things down to what's going on. But it's, criminals are getting more intelligent because of, like we talked about, all the information out there. So we're going to have to get more intelligent in our awareness in things and how we do things. I'm a very positive person. I mean, I'm a follower of Christ. I'm positive. I believe in goodness. But we got to be aware. I had a friend of mine share something with me 2 days ago, a woman friend of mine. I think she's like 40 now. She said about 7 or 8 years ago, this car turns around on the road and just starts literally following and just comes right behind her and follows her.
Oh.
And she said, maybe I'm paranoid. So I'm going to take a weird road and just see if they turn. They turn with them. They turn on another one. They turn with them. And so she ended up going to where her husband worked.
Good.
And like, there's like a check-in gate. She almost crashes into the check-in gate to get there and said, "Hey, go get my husband, this guy." And the guy pulled up behind them. And one of the work guys went and confronted him. And this guy had a woman's wig on. And he ends up being, creeps out on him. And then he leaves. But he had saw her, something about her registered with this guy, and followed her all around. And I think with the internet and things like that, we have these people doing this to us without us knowing it because of our electronic imprint.
Oh, sure.
People following and doing things. That's why I like when I do a public appearances and things like that. I'm very, I'm very guarded sometimes. And I kind of listen to what people are saying about how much they know about certain things. And if they ever cross a line of saying too much about, you know, a certain family member of mine or too much information, I'm going, they got too much of an interest here. There's no reason for me talking about dangerous wildlife for them to ask me about some family event that I went to. Then they live a state away from me, you know?
Like, hey, you know, if we were having a casual conversation over barbecue at the last show and then I see you again, you know, that's a different story. But and I use the turn of phrase all the time of, you know, lightly Google stalking my guests.
Lightly Google stalking. I had a guy show up.
That was my job as a former on-air producer, was like, hey, go find this guest. So I would have to, like, it's not like we had a phone number to go contact the guest. So it was my job to Google stalk a guest. And to find where they were publicly available and how to get in touch with them and, you know, and find out what they're all about. So, whenever I hop on the phone for the first time with somebody and I know all these things, they're like, whoa, how do you know all that? I'm like, I was lightly Google stalking you before our first meeting.
I had a guy 20 years ago show up at my parents' house looking for me.
Oh.
A guy that I had shot photos of. No, and this was right before digital photography was good enough to use in publications. And I was shooting slide film. And I had taken pictures on this fishing trip for a magazine of him catching fish and stuff like that and been published. And he had called me and wanted copies of pictures. Said, I don't even have them right now. If I get them back from the magazine, I'll send you a couple. Well, he called again a week later. I said, man, I don't have this stuff. And I kind of forgot about it. And then my mom calls me, hey, this guy just showed up at our house. He lived 3 hours away. Wow. And my dad had the same name. He showed up at my house. And I was eating dinner at another friend's house. And I came over there and I felt like Darth Vader in the Return of Revenge of the Sith.
Yeah.
When I walked up, I was like, pal, I was not happy with him, you know. But it was just, you know, it could happen to anybody. So we got to be careful out there and do that. And there's a lot of stuff, and there's a lot of, you know, there is an entertainment component to what you and I do. We're providing people with a way, but it's also what we do is informational. You know, we're trying to provide good information.
Yeah.
And I'm excited about where the Dark Outdoors platform is going. And because
I'm excited for you, dude. It's fantastic to see you win those awards. That's great. That's great. Well, hard earned and well deserved, man.
I appreciate, especially coming from you, I respect, you know, the level of real journalism you do and the excellence you put in all your digital platforms. And, you know, I'm working on a book. I was going to have a book this year, but what I had was too Texas, Louisiana centric.
Okay.
Because that's where I live. I live in this region. And I needed stuff more from around the nation that fit these profiles. So by next fall, for sure, there will be a Dark Outdoors book.
Awesome.
And what I have so far is wild.
I'll bet.
And there's going to be, we won an award for a documentary they called Journey into the Dark Outdoors. And that was based on my first Dark Outdoors talk where I announced it at my friend Craig Wohener's Falcon Monster Festival.
Yep.
And we're going to do a much more in-depth documentary, and it's gonna involve crimes of recognition stuff, and we're gonna see where it goes. We'll begin filming some of this next week. So a lot of things going on out there, and you know, as an investigator, it's fascinating to look at some of this. And but here's the testimony though. one of the things I give this free PDF to people, and it's my dark outdoor safety tips.
Oh, and awesome.
And I, if anybody wants it, email me at chester@chestermoore.com and I'll email it to you for free. Again, and it's the things I personally do. And I mean, our slogan is pray, prepare.
I will make sure to put it in our knowledge vault.
Yeah, I'll do that.
And put links to it on our website.
I'll do that. And I give it to people. And one of the things is very simple. I call it strategic parking. Mm. When I go into an area, and I always make sure that I park. There's two things about how I park. That I'm parked the direction that I need to retreat from their area.
Yep.
So I don't have to back up. And that comes from watching slasher flicks as a kid. You know, you back up at Camp Crystal Lake and Jason sticks a machete through the windshield. I mean, that's just common 80s kids sense.
I don't think I ever saw the Dukes of Hazzard have to kick it in reverse to get out of there.
No, the Dukes knew what was up. But the dumb teenagers at Camp Crystal Lake had no idea. Yeah, they're going to park in the mud puddle.
Absolutely.
And so park where you're – if you got to turn around, do whatever. Park exactly the direction you need to go. But also park where you can see if you're hiking or camping or fishing or hunting. Park where you can see your vehicle from at least 50 yards away and approach it slowly and quietly to make sure no one is casing you and waiting there in that spot.
Oh,
so that's one of the things. Here's cool. I've had at least five people tell me they now park strategically because of the podcast, just out of the blue, which was great.
That's awesome.
And I had another woman who goes out and collects arrowheads and just whatever. She looks on by herself in the middle of nowhere and bring Daisy Dukes and stuff and posting it on social media. She's quit the social posting.
Good.
And she said she's going to a concealed carry class.
Good.
So making people think more. So that's really the realm of this that we want to get to is saving lives. Cause look, I'm from Texas and I'm not politically correct. Okay. And I'm not a violent man.
You are real as the world around you, buddy.
If a modern day Ted Bundy comes between me and my family in the woods, they're going to be doing an autopsy on the modern day Ted Bundy, not on me and my family.
Yeah, I'll tell them where to find the body.
Yeah, we're going to go over here and there's the body. I'm coming out. My family is going to come out of the woods. Yeah. This guy might not make it. It's his choice. So it's all about that. And even like the dangerous wildlife stuff, man. I mean, the dog show, the most downloaded dark outdoor show, believe it or not, was my feral dog attack show.
Oh, I wouldn't doubt it. I wouldn't doubt it.
And I've had my own run-ins with that, and they're on the show. And the amount – so what's happening now is, people are not taking their dogs to kill shelters. And if they can't take care of them, and a lot of cities still have kill shelters, and they're letting these dogs that were too aggressive for their home loose in the woods.
Yep. And then they pack up.
I saw at one of my favorite fishing spots about, I think it was probably in April, I saw it was a Rottweiler, a Pit Bull, a German Shepherd, and a Labrador someone had dropped off as a pack.
Wow.
Now, I was like, holy smokes. Wow. I hope they're friendly. Because if they get hungry, those are big dogs. And what about a little kid out here fishing? So, it's also that situational awareness of that. And it comes funny stuff always ends up happening to me. So I'm in Yellowstone. I'm from Orange, Texas. We don't have bears here. We got occasional bears come from Louisiana.
My family's from Yellowstone Channel View and all that kind of stuff, brother. So
I'm out in Yellowstone the first time 4 years ago, and I saw a grizzly in the distance. I was so pumped. I photographed it, and I love that. Went back fishing 2 years ago in Yellowstone by myself, and the area that I wanted to go into was like I could only see from the creek about 20 yards, and it was brush and woods. And I'm like, I'm by myself. If a grizzly pops up, it's going to be right there. Just not smart right now, right? So I went to another area where I had a more wide open area. I could kind of keep scanning, looking around, caught a bunch of fish, went back to the same spot this year, and then I stopped at another location. And thought, oh, this is really great. And I caught some Yellowstone cutthroat. I was happy. Drive a mile down the road, and I posted the photo the other day of a mega sow grizzly and her two cubs. And I'm like, I'm glad I saw them while I was still in my vehicle and didn't see them across the stream from me. But when I went to that first trip there, the first place I went was outside of Bozeman, Montana, at a public trout fishing area, like a park. And it was just a walking trail and a stream that ran through the city there. And I said, there's not going to probably be any grizzlies. It's possible. And I was told moose come in to be careful. I'm fly fishing. And I caught a couple of rainbows. This is so cool. It's a river runs through it. I'm a Texas kid, Montana, you know, and I have a good time. And I hear behind me. And I'm pretty far back in this area on the edge of like where National Forest starts. And I look up and I'm on a kind of a bank that goes, and I'm on the bottom of the bank of the river, and it goes up, and I see this tall grass and something mottled like gray and brown walks through the brush. And I hear, and I'm like, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. Please don't die, you know? And I'm like, keep fishing. And I'm just looking. All of a sudden, I'm thinking it's a grizzly. It's a bear. Something's going on. It sounded like one. And I look below me, and there's the biggest standard poodle I've ever seen in my entire life. This poodle must have been 15. It was like about to die of heat exhaustion. It was like, and it just soaked itself in the stream. It's like, and I'm loving on this poor poodle. And I'm like, I've never been, so I don't even like poodles. I love you now. I might get one. I'm so happy you're a grizzly. And then I hear a guy holler out the name Sadie. And I'm like, I bet this is some guy's dog. And I walked up and hollered, are you looking for a poodle? And there's this guy about a quarter mile away screaming, yes, she's down here.
Scared and I'm like, by a poodle stream fishing. So
Chester Moore, who investigates the smiley face killers and of cage diver great white shark, was scared out of his wits by a 15-year-old standard poodle.
Well, it, you know, it's one of those, many people are not aware of those situations, like wild packs of dogs, especially in their local communities. That is, once again, one of those situations that you'll see pretty regularly in local forests up around suburban areas, things like
that's
that.
That's the worst. That's the worst area for it, because they'll drive to like the edge of the city.
People don't realize how close wild hogs are to city. Like my brother, had private property in Katy, Texas, right? Like blocks away from Katy Mills Mall. His brother-in-law used to trap hogs on their property.
There was a lady.
That's how close they are to civilization and people.
There was a lady last year whose dog was attacked walking in a park in Katy, and she got knocked over. In Anahuac, which is between Beaumont and Houston, 4 years ago now, a lady was killed in a yard by feral hogs. And here's the thing. Everybody – and one of the key – we have one of my shows I did this with a great hog
and
expert.
That's a big one that you got there, man.
Like, yeah, you know, that thing that,
that's what people don't realize is that they get big. Like
they
like,
get huge.
Like medium-sized bear big.
I actually have a guy did artwork for me, and he had the average size grizzly, which is 500 pounds. The average size black bear is 300, in the middle, a 400-pound hog, which is a rarity to get that big, but they can get that big. There are bear-sized hogs running around these areas. I trapped four of them out of my city limits where I live in West Orange, Texas, four years ago, and there are hogs that have been on my property at the Kingdom Zoo Wildlife Center because we have woods back here and along the edge of the city. And there's an interesting intertwining between animal conflict and dogs and people. We all love our dogs. I've got a bull mastiff and I got a dobie, and you better not come in my house unless we like you, all right? and after my dobie thrashes you to death, my bull mastiff will come do the death blow, you know what I mean? But you know, it's funny because we use them for kids and our outreach. We love kids, but like, you jack with us, it's over, you know? And people love to take their dogs walking in these areas, and if you look into, I'm not even talking about just feral hogs and bears, moose and elk attacks on people. Dogs are involved in about 75% of them.
Oh, I wouldn't doubt it.
Because the hogs and the elk and the moose and the bears hate the dog. They see him as an enemy, and they're just going to mow you over at the same time. So if you see feral hogs signing your favorite park, don't bring your dog out there. That's going to increase the chances of you being attacked greatly and your dog certainly being hurt, you know?
Really, really good point, man. And whenever you're talking about things like Hogzilla and stuff like that, I am one of those that, like, I believe it fully in the realm of possibility because all it takes is a single domestic hog
to get loose.
And most people don't realize that, like, domestic hogs get big.
Dr. Jack Mayer of the Savannah Laboratory was on Dark Outdoors. He's the world's foremost hog attack expert.
Oh, wow.
And it's on a Dark Outdoors episode. And I asked him how long it took a domestic pig, if it got loose, to go feral.
They start going feral within days.
Yeah, he said there's no real timeline. He goes, it depends on the individual and where they're at environmentally.
Yeah.
But he said their behavior will almost immediately switch.
Yep.
And then they'll start growing longer hair and all that
stuff.
They'll
start growing tusks.
So what happens is,
next generation will all be feral.
There are areas where there are massive feral hogs. Mm-hmm. And when I look at them, they look like domestic hogs.
Yes.
There is a lot of old school
Texas. The short snout.
Yeah, short there's snout, old ideology long of farmers snout. And stuff that hogs kill snakes. So I have talked to multiple people who run cattle and stuff on islands and along the coast that they used to put big domestic, like Duroc, Yorkshire, these kind of domestic breeds that get 700-800 pounds.
Yeah, yeah.
Out in the wild. And when me and Lisa were first dating, I took her to a seafood restaurant on the edge of the Neches River, and I go open the door for her like the chivalry wasn't dead back then, you know, and I hear the brush popping, and right in front of me, in front of the seafood restaurant, which is on the edge of this river, was a white, covered in a lot of mud hog. It looked like it came off a farm, but had longer hair, and he probably weighed 700 pounds.
Wow. Wow.
But there's all these things like this, and in a lot of hunting ranches that wanted big hogs, they'll go buy. People don't know this, but they'll buy domestic stock and stock with their stuff to create these super pigs.
Yeah.
And but it's not even the giant ones that'll hurt you; it can be the little guy and the sows.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a point I want to get across. So one of the cutest things in nature is a feral hog sow, a baby, a little piglet.
Yeah, they are.
A lot of times they have stripes on them.
Little baby cute guys.
And little bitty stripes on them. They're about that big. And what happens is little Susie from
baby
Austin.
Baby gator's cute too.
Yeah, my example always little Susie from Austin, who has the gluten-free sandwiches and the essential oils and stuff. And she goes out and she's a peace lover, man. She wouldn't hurt an ant, right? And she's out and she's in the park and she sees these little bitty baby pigs all by themselves.
Oh, look at them. They're so cute.
And then all hell breaks loose because mama comes out the bushes and mama will eat your soul. And so you got to be careful of that as well. And if you see cute little piglets, leave them alone.
Yeah.
Because mama's not far. She's going to be only far enough where she can hear them squeal.
Yep.
And that's another thing.
Fast.
Yeah. And you know, the big ones you talked about, I mean, I think for sure that there are 800 to 1,000 pound pigs out there
in the
wilds of the South. I think they're not common.
Just for the sake of escaped domestic hogs.
And you think about
going into the wild and living.
And there's a thing called hybrid vigor. Live. There's a thing called hybrid vigor where, you know, first generation hybrids often are bigger and more powerful.
Absolutely.
So if you have one of these Durocs get loose from a farm and it breeds with an old feral hog, because look, these feral hogs are not real choicy. They're like domestic, wild. I don't care. I want to hook up. They breed with everything.
Even if a pregnant hog gets out, every baby that comes out will be feral.
Yeah, and while they're not going to necessarily have the, they're not going to have the
domestic. They change while they gestate. It's crazy.
They're not going to have the nutrition of a the easy life of a domestic one. They're still going to be leaner and bigger and taller and overall bigger. And I've seen some of these pigs in the wild before. That like the one I saw 30 years ago. And then I probably get more hog photos sent to me than anyone in America because of my book, Hog Wild.
Yep.
And I've probably done more on the giant hogs and cities than anyone on research. And people always sending me photos. And now the trend the last 5 years has been people in Houston, people in Tampa, who have 5 acres on the edge of the city, or they're in the city. What? And now they got this 250-pound boar with 6-inch tusk in their backyard. And so it's a different world out there when it comes to these animals. And the thing about hogs, they're hyper intelligent.
Yeah. They're very smart.
A lot of people who hunt deer and end up killing hogs think hogs are stupid because their deer feeder will go off and a bunch of young pigs come in real easy the first couple of times. Then they shoot them, they don't come back. Well, that's young ones. Once they get past about that first year, we're talking genius level psychology here on a pig.
Yeah, I don't think people remember Green Acres. That pig did all those things.
You
gotta
have Green Acres in your thing. You know? Yeah, I mean, Wilbur. Was it Wilbur?
Pigs are smart.
Yeah, yeah. Pigs are very, very smart. Charlotte's Web, man. But there are, here's what you need to remember when you think hog safety. Hannibal.
Yes.
Yeah. Lord have mercy. Remember Hannibal, and that'll keep you safe from pigs.
That's right.
You know?
That's right. But this is not to make anybody, once again, like I used to go out and walk Buffalo Bayou in Houston. Don't know that I would in that capacity anymore, but I am not afraid of the outdoors. I'm not afraid to go to a public park, a state park, things like that.
No, me either. I do it all the time.
But I will still always be fully aware of my surroundings, and you should always.
For sure. And here's the thing. If you have one inkling of a thought, you shouldn't go into an area. Don't go.
Yeah.
There's always another spot to go another time. And that's a key thing. We're not trying to raise fear. We're trying to raise awareness.
Exactly.
And that's the important. I'm glad you brought that up, Chris, because that's an important part of this is the fact situational awareness. And there are areas I just don't go anymore because of the criminal activity. It doesn't matter if the fish are there. I got fish in other places. For example, Mexico. All right. I ain't going back down to Mexico. It ain't happening.
Yeah.
And I got offered in my position as a wildlife journalist.
I get offered wild bass fishing down there, man. I knew people peacock bass fishing all the time, things like that.
In the late 90s, I went down there to Lake Aguamilpa on the Pacific coast and caught 350 bass in 3 days, including my largest to date, a 9-pounder. And the crazy part was I was shooting photos for magazines half the time. I probably could have caught 500, 600, you know, it was incredible.
Yeah.
And about five years ago before the pandemic, I got offered to go down to another one of those lakes and I got offered they take pay my flight, everything, give me a bunch of tackle because they wanted people to come down and write about it. Right. And get the word out. And I said, thank you for thinking of me. I appreciate this, but the bottom line is there's no cartel on Sam Rayburn and there's not a war going on the streets in Jasper. So I'm going to go up the road and fish up there. And, you know, it's just situational awareness and thinking sometimes, you know what, I can catch a bigger fish maybe there, but I can still catch a fish over here and maybe not have the dangers. And also another thing is just not limiting yourself.
Yeah.
You know, you might think I've always been someone who liked to walk, you know, this, whatever, we'll find new places or new things if things are changing differently and just look at it differently and use it as like a thing to educate. If you have kids and all of a sudden you see feral hogs, that's an educational moment. Yeah. You have an invasive exotic coming into your city and area. This is why we shouldn't be here. And we hope we can control these animals for our native wildlife's sake and things like that. And I think there's always a chance to educate and hopefully inspire people to go out there and stay alive, man.
I am the same way, man. I spent years working with teenagers, kids, junior high, my son is 6. Not too long ago, during the heat of the summer, as things, it was right after that first like 2-3 weeks where it was like 100 degrees before it was like 2 months of it. And I went to go check the mail one day and picked my shoe up, and under my shoe was a decent sized scorpion.
There we go.
Well, I've been knocking my shoes since.
they'll do it.
Been knocking my shoes every day since. But I kept it in a jar until my kid got back. My wife was like, what are you doing? I was like, I'm going to show him. And I took it out and I put it in a big glass bowl with a big pair of tongs and showed him the stinger with the magnifying glass and educated him. Cool. And I was like, hey, man, you see this, you come tell dad, don't you play with it.
Like, exactly.
You come tell mom, you come tell dad, you see anything with more legs than you have, you come tell us.
I love it. That's a great way to look at that.
Don't go playing with it.
He'll never forget that, though. So that's
within 3 weeks, he came to me in the living room and was like, dad, there's one of those bugs in my room.
Oh,
and
cool.
I went in, so- I mean like inch long total. He saw it on the floor and came and got me.
So there you go. So he's already becoming aware of his, you know, his wildlife and appreciates it. And
I could have made that a scary experience.
Yep.
I could have made it all kinds of things. I made it interesting instead and used it as a moment to teach him to, hey, don't be afraid of him, man. Because of that, we ain't got cockroaches.
That, you know, yeah, it's like
it's a friendly
like
bug. It's only going to bite you if you jack with it.
I like
snakes. Scorpion hunting you down. Oh, I'm a huge snake fan.
Huge I love snakes, fan. But if there's a copperhead in my yard in the city, you probably ain't going to make it. I ain't going to take time to relocate him at night. But I've never killed a non-venomous snake on my property ever. Nope. I like having rat snakes around. They keep the rats away.
Yeah.
You know, and that's also a cool thing to teach people. And, you know, I like when I do seminars on this stuff. If you want a speaking engagement, I'm a pretty good talker. I love to come out to your event and speak. If anybody has inquiries on that, you can email me, chester@chestermoore.com for speaking. I do a lot of that stuff. And you open up the questions, of course, at the end. And most people ask great questions. But sometimes they don't like the answer to the question. I gave one at an event in the last few months, and they asked me, and they're like, so if you're in the woods and you're with your family and you see a guy with a butcher knife walking down the trail towards you in a white hood on, what are you going to do? I'm going to say, boom, stop or I'll shoot. And they were like, oh, my God, he's so violent, you know. And I'm like, well, here's the thing. My idea is
I said
me and my family are going to go home.
I didn't.
Yeah, it's like, boom, stop or I'll shoot.
Yeah.
That's a warning shot for all you PC people.
That's right.
To let them know I'm serious. The next one will be center mass.
Yeah. One's in the air.
One's in the air. And maybe grazing the head. I don't know. But you know, it's like, you know, you got to have fun with this. And that was kind of a flippant, fun answer.
Yeah.
But, you know, the whole thing is I want good family people who are out to just enjoy themselves, to stay alive, stay healthy, have an incredible time, enjoy the outdoors. And the work we do with children, our missions, bring the love of Christ to hurting kids through wildlife encounters, that's my heart.
I love what you do with Higher Calling, man. It is such a beautiful thing. It's amazing.
I appreciate that. And I'm about to have an opportunity. I can circle back with another show when I get it done. We're filming a documentary about that as well.
Yeah.
And I get to work with one of the kids you worked with before and a new little boy. If you have a child that loves wildlife and it's been through maybe lost a parent or a sibling or struggling with major depression or has a critical illness or things like that, reach out to me. We would love to do some kind of special wildlife encounter for them. That's my heart. And that's where really the vigilance that I have in my voice for this comes from, seeing what happens to kids. Seeing the tragedies that befall people. Yeah, that picture right there is me and Olivia, and she wanted to get the shark cage. So me and her at the shark cage at the Texas State Aquarium.
Dude, too cool.
And I just took another girl this summer named Erica Shea. She and I went into the same shark cage, and she even had a better time. So that's kids right there that are getting to go with us to release wild turkeys with the National Wild Turkey Federation, Texas Parks and Wildlife.
Awesome.
And we want to plant seeds in them to do great for wildlife and give them hope and purpose in what they do. And so it's all about loving the kids and making sure they're safe. And like I said, a lot of this circles around my experience, Dark Outdoors, and then the case of that missing girl being found where everybody in our community fishes.
Yeah.
You know, so it comes back to those tragedies and wanting to give kids love and light and purpose and hope and that's what keeps me motivated and going, man. Like,
absolutely.
I can check out around adults pretty quick sometimes because I'm just a big kid.
Yeah.
But when I get around kids, man, I get motivated, and I want to let them know that life can still be good even when hardships come. You know,
I have seen you in action on site, man, and it is a beautiful thing. You have a heart banger in your head, brother.
I appreciate that, man.
It's amazing. It's amazing, and I love it.
I don't get a lot of things right, probably, but I think I get helping kids right, and I love doing it. So if there's a family out there that has that wildlife loving kid, or I'm going to also offer this.
Yeah.
If you have a kid who loves Bigfoot and has been through the same thing, we have done multiple Bigfoot research expeditions for kids. I just took a family of four out 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago.
Too cool.
And we take thermal imaging. We take night vision. We audio recording and all that stuff and go to legitimate research areas. Because I got to thinking, there's a lot of kids into this stuff. And
yeah,
if we can provide them with something amazing like that, reach out to me. We can make something special happen for a kiddo.
That is great, man. That's awesome. I love hearing that. Way to bring the two communities together. That is beautiful.
So the third, our Wild Wish programs right now have 223 kids in it.
Wow.
And the third kid we ever did a thing for was a Bigfoot expedition.
Man.
And we did that, and then we did one for a kid at the Bigfoot conference, thanks to my friend Craig Woolheater.
Yep.
I'm doing the same thing in Tennessee at the Tennessee Wild Man Conference and Crypticon with Randy Hutchings in a few weeks in Tennessee. And we're going to be doing another one at the Texas Bigfoot Conference. And but that first one was special. That kid was really blown away. And after that, he wanted to meet the cast of Finding Bigfoot. And so I got offered to be on Finding Bigfoot for an episode.
Yeah.
And I turned it down. But I kept in touch with the producer and I said, hey, I got this kid. Could he come meet the cast? Cause they were doing a town hall thing in Lufkin, Texas.
Uh-huh.
And he said, yeah, we'll set it up. But I don't always trust producers and they get busy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I remember going, I had met Bobo back in 2002 in Bluff Creek or 2003 maybe. And I thought maybe he'll remember me or I doubt it, but maybe he will. We pull up to the building and there's Bobo on the cell phone outside the building. And this kid's eyes are like this, you know? And we get out and he hangs up the phone and he goes, Chester Moore, what's up? And I got a picture of him with the kid and he took him in to meet Cliff and Renee and they were so nice and it was incredible. So if we can inspire a Bigfoot loving kid out there, we love That's to great. Work on some kind of special expedition for him.
Whatever gets him out in the fresh air and in the sunshine, man, like honestly. The outdoors is such an important thing and the appreciation of the outdoors. I was brought up hunting and fishing as a kid. It took me to amazing places and gave me an amazing appreciation of the beauty of nature and the world around me and my connection to it in a totally different way.
Agreed, man. Yesterday, I've gotten to, I love fly fishing. I just broke my record for my largest bass ever on the fly yesterday. And I felt like a 5-year-old kid out there. I'm 49.
Yeah.
So that tells you that the nature can do great things no matter what your age, no matter where you're from. Nature is a great equalizer that anyone can enjoy and have a great time.
The ultimate equalizer, man. You ain't going to escape nature. It ain't going to happen. So, Chester, I want to thank you for your time, man. Thank you so much for this. I want to have you on again and again and again.
Hey man, it's an honor to be on your show. I love the questions you ask and the way you let guests tell their story and pull better stories out of us. So I salute you, brother.
Oh, thank you so much. Let everybody know where they can go to contact you at Higher Calling Wildlife, where they can go to get a kid help, where they can go to follow everything at Dark Outdoors and everything you do, bud.
Yeah, there's a lot of sites. You go to higher calling.net. There's links to everything on there. You can go at the Chester Moore on Instagram, Higher Calling Wildlife on Facebook, and kingdomzoo.com goes through our overarching ministry work and a lot of things going on. And a lot of ways to connect. Email me, chester@chestermoore.com, and we'll make something happen.
Awesome, man. And of course, you know, make sure to look out for his shows at Dark Outdoors Podcast, everybody. That's where you can go to follow the RSS feed. That's where you can go to check out all the stories and to share your story with him as well. So
yeah, if you got a crazy dark outdoor story, please contact me. I love getting listener feedback and content. That's the way a lot of great shows are organically put together. Yep. And we got a special season coming up here in October. We're going to have four episodes in a row, and we brought to you, and we're going to be doing kind of a special project where we're giving copies of the new remastered Legend of Boggy Creek.
Cool.
Away. And they just got released right now. Go to legendofboggycreek.com for information how to get that. But we're giving away some copies and doing a special episode for Halloween Day on the Legend of Boggy Creek at the end of it. But we got some crazy wild outdoor true crime stuff. And, going to be a fun month, man. We're going to try to keep you scared a little bit and safe.
I will say my October ends with a bang. Stay tuned here on Halloween night, folks, because Halloween night is our official 100th episode.
Wow.
It didn't even dawn. Like, I have been so slammed going across the country covering events and things like that for the last month, man. I didn't even realize it till today. When we went to record this, I was looking at my Google calendar, booking all these interviews for when I leave town and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, holy crap. We're almost at episode 100. When is that?
Whoa, well, congratulations on that. I'll have to tune into that, man.
Absolutely.
That's awesome.
It'll be a fun one. So I'm going to try and come up with something good and spooky to talk about. So
that's perfect. So that's what we're doing, our Legend of Boggy Creek episode. Nice. So that'll be fun.
Well, hold the line real quick, man. While I close things out, while you are online checking out all of the amazing work of Chester Moore, everybody, of course, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com/video is where you can go and follow all of the YouTube channels of all of our guests, including Chester Moore, Paradigm Research Group. That's where you can find the playlists of all of the events that we sponsor, things like the second annual Dogman Conference that just happened, MUFON Symposium, Texas Bigfoot Convention, all that kind of good stuff. That's where you can also like, follow, subscribe, everything else. Thank you so much, as always, everybody, for tuning in, for staying tuned in all of these years. Thank you so much for your open hearts, your open minds. Remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault on our website, CuriousRealm.com. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast services, as well as YouTube, Roku, Amazon Fire, and Apple TV through the APR TV app, available on all app markets. Curious Realm is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more great content or to become a sponsor of Curious Realm or other podcasts, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.